It's time for TWiT This Week in Tech. We've got a great panel. Callie Lewis is back. Luria Petrucci joins us, along with Kurt Wagner and my buddy Jason Snell. We're going to talk about the latest news. What's Facebook up to with this new video thing? Callie's doing it, and a lot more. Stay tuned. TWiT is next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is TWiT, This Week in Tech, episode 561, recorded Sunday, May 8th, 2016. There's always a Steve. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Braintree. Mobile app development can be complex, but integrating your payments no longer has to be. With Braintree, your business can accept nearly every type of payment from any device with just one integration. Learn more at BraintreePayments.com/TWiT. And by Squarespace. Squarespace is the simplest way to create a cover page or beautiful website for your portfolio, blog, business, or online store. Enter the offer code TWiT and get 10% off. And by GoToMeeting. Be a meeting MVP. GoToMeeting is the online meeting tool that lets you easily collaborate and present from anywhere with one click, so you always put on your best performance. Step up your meeting game and start your free 30-day trial at GoToMeeting.com. And by Stamps.com. Here's an easy way for you to save time for your business. Avoid trips to the post office and use Stamps.com to buy postage right at your desk. To get my special offer, go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone, and enter TWiT. It's time for TWiT This Week in Tech, the show where we cover the week's tech news. Hello there. How are you? Good to see you. You're going to like this show because I have some really good people for you. We've gathered together, starting with Jason Snell, who drove up the road a piece and is joining us.
Howdy.
Good to see you from the Incomparable and SixColors.com.
Yes, sir.
Incomparable is a podcast. Six Colors is a really good website.
Thank you.
Yeah. Covering, it implies Macintosh.
Yeah, it's mostly, that's where I've been covering Apple for 20 years, so it's that and other stuff, too.
Yeah, but there's other stuff in there, too. Also with us, great to have him from, and I think it's his first time on TWiT, Recode.net. It's Kurt Wagner. Kurt, great to see you.
Hey. This is my first time.
And the timing is good because the newly recasted Recode website has been launched. The slash is gone, baby.
Long live the slash. I think we just pushed that live, actually, like around noon Pacific today. So, we're talking hours old.
You surprised us. I like it.
Kara teased it out a little last week, but, we like to mix it up, keep things fresh.
Did you go to Recode with Kara from the Journal? You were at the Journal, right?
I was at Mashable.
Six
months after Recode became Recode from All Things Digital, of course. So,
yes.
Been there almost 2 years now.
Wow. Has it been that long?
Yeah, two and a half years.
It must be because it's almost a year now since Vox bought you guys.
I know. That's hard to believe. We're getting ready for, we have our big code conference at the end of May, early June. And I was just thinking about that myself over the weekend, how it's hard to believe that was a whole year ago that we found out we were joining the Vox family. It's been a good year, though.
Time flies.
Flies, man.
I was just trying to think what we should talk about this week. There's a lot of kind of more philosophical stories. I don't know. Wait a minute. I didn't introduce somebody beautiful. I'm sorry. Luria Petrucci's here. Oh, my God. Luria, it's good to see you.
Did he just flash me up on screen to get your attention?
Yeah. I completely forgot. No, it's great to see you because you're doing a new thing.
I'll just go away.
No. You may remember Luria as Callie Lewis, and I'm getting that out of the way because I will probably call her Callie at some point or other, and you'll all be baffled. But Luria, of course, is wonderful. She's now up in the Pacific Northwest doing a new venture. It's kind of looks kind of interesting. It's a beautiful studio, geeksuniversity.com.
Yeah. So I do all my tech stuff at geekslife.com.
You're still doing Geeks Life.
And okay. Lifestyle, right?
Okay.
But we're also teaching businesses how to, you know, entrepreneurs, small business owners, how to use live streaming and online video for their businesses, because I've been doing it for so long and I've learned so much over the years. And so we actually are doing two daily live streams on Facebook. I think we're the first people to do a daily live show on Facebook. And so we're doing the Geeks Life Daily Show there at facebook.com/geekslifenet. And then we're also doing a business show over there at geeks/geeksuniversity. And so, so Geeks Life and Geeks University, we have a ton going on over here. But I love to help other people learn how to do kind of what we do for a living.
I'm really intrigued by this Facebook Live thing. I think we're going to talk a lot about video today. Facebook launched, and again, I don't know if this is only on my app, so you guys can confirm this. My app has changed a lot. This is the Facebook app. And this is, you'll like this, Luria. Now, in addition to news feed and people, there's a new video button that if I touch that, it shows video. Facebook is all in. Well, look at that. Oh, you're right there.
I was doing one earlier this morning. How about that?
Facebook is all in on video to the point where they're surfacing it as an equal to the news feed.
Yeah, well, Mark Zuckerberg came out recently and said, I mean, at the F8 conference, he was talking about how important live video is to them. And they are freaking killing it in the live streaming space. You know, Leo, you've been doing live streaming for years. You do it kind of on a more...
I'm going to buy a full page ad in the New York Times that says, "Welcome, Facebook." Seriously.
But with mobile live streaming, I mean, they're really doing a whole lot in that space. And so we wanted to make sure that we were kind of in that and killing it in that space as well. So we figured out how to use a live stream HD 550 studio box.
So that's my question, because I know how to do this because, you know, it has a go live button right here and I can just go live from my phone. And that's actually interesting because that's also been around in this, but it was a little harder to find. If you wanted to post to Facebook, you'd have to tap what's on your mind and then scroll down and then you'd see the go live. In fact, for a while, I didn't even think this was in the Facebook for Android version, but now
that just was released like 2 days ago.
Yeah, but now, and they've really, because of this video button, and so everybody has this video button now. You have it, Jason?
No.
Not on iOS yet.
They're rolling it out, I believe. I think they announced it a few weeks ago, right before F8. So,
and then
probably slow rollout.
Tell me, Kirk, if you have this, because on the bottom of my Facebook, this is new too, I have categories. So I have news feed, but I also have world and U.S. news, funny. There's a whole bunch of subject matter, and I can even turn it on or off with the settings button. I'm thinking I must be in some sort of a beta test of this. Sorry, it's so bright. I should turn my screen brightness down.
I think you're getting this not necessarily something that's totally new. I know that people have written about that a few months ago, but at the same time, I don't have that.
Yeah,
a lot of people I've seen have not had it, so I do think you're one of the lucky few. They somehow picked you.
I don't know if I feel so lucky.
Test all of these.
It's interesting though, because what it really tells me, both this scroll bar at the bottom and the new video category at the top, is that Facebook wants to be a media company, not a social network. Right, Kurt? Is that fair to say?
I think that they want to do a lot of stuff. And if you were at F8, you could see that ultimately, the one thing I will give Facebook is that they really stay true to that mission, which is about connecting people. And it sounds a little corny. It sounds a little cliche. But everything that they do, right? I mean, the fact that they're trying to set up Wi-Fi-enabled cities. They're going to test something in San Jose, California around that. The fact that they have internet beaming drones, you know, it's all about getting people onto the internet and therefore, you know, connecting them with the different apps that they have. I think the way that they keep you coming back is through the media and entertainment part of it, right? Because I'm only going to log on to Facebook if I'm exchanging a message or if I have a comment on something that I posted. But the reason I open the app every single day, even when I don't have those things happening, is because there's great videos and there's great stories and all these other things that I read. So I don't know if they would describe themselves as a media company, but I could, you know, they've married media and communication in a way that hardly, I don't think anyone else has really done. I think Snapchat's trying to do it, but that's about it.
And I'll add on to that, Kurt. That's a very good point. But they, because of their ad platform and how prominent that is and how many, how much money they make off of it, you know, that's a big deal for them. They have to keep that attention coming back over and over and over in order to make sure that people continue to have effectiveness with those ads. And of course, they're putting so much effort into people who use that. Like, you almost can't necessarily be effective if you don't use it, which is kind of a negative. But if you have high engagement, you can kind of get over that. So, you know, it's, I saw somebody in the chat room. I'm sorry, I missed your name a minute ago, who said, you know, they're focusing on celebrities. And they always start with celebrities. Then they always kind of roll it out to the masses.
And Facebook Live is for everybody now. And it's not just for less celebrities.
Well, they're paying. They're paying those.
But they are paying some people.
They're paying celebrities and they're paying some media partners, too. So, you know, that's something that, as far as I know, Twitter and Periscope have never been willing to do. And I think, you know, it's going to – you're going to assume certain things. Okay, Facebook's now paying for this. Eventually, they're going to want to pull that back and figure out another way, because you can't afford to pay people for content forever. But at the same time, I mean, look at – you look at all the people who are broadcasting on Facebook Live in the last 3 months. I mean, it wasn't even a thing. Basically, we didn't even talk about this at the turn of the year, January 1st. Now every single publisher and every single media property around is going live on a regular basis. So it's working. The problem is, like, okay, now can they transition from, hey, we've been paying you all along, to we want you to do this, you know, because you want to do it, not because we're giving you money. And so they're going to have to figure out a way to monetize it in a way that that's, you know, keeps that incentive high.
Facebook's not paying you, Kelly, right? This is a platform
No.
for you. But I wonder, do you worry about going all in as you have on Facebook? Because it's not.
So,
I mean, it's.
Yeah, that's a
it's not your platform.
Point. Right, exactly. You never want to, like, go all in on somebody else's platform.
Well, it's just risky.
It is risky. I mean, you can if you have a strategy behind you to get people on to your own platform, right? So, and that's the way we use it.
So you're using it as a way to promote what you're doing elsewhere.
Not fully. I mean, yes. So we have that strategy in place, and we always drive traffic to our own properties. You know, so from a business perspective, you have to think about that kind of thing. From, you know, a content perspective, you don't get our content live unless you are there live on Facebook. We do release that content later.
Well, it stays on Facebook, right? I mean, people can now
exactly.
see it. If you're in my feed, I missed the first show, but I could see it because it's in my feed. Jason, would you, you're a content creator as much as anybody, would you consider creating a Facebook-specific show live on Facebook?
I think you have to consider the power of Facebook and its ability to reach an audience. But at the same time, I mean, I also think a lot of video producers are already dealing with a major platform that is taking up a lot of their oxygen, which is YouTube, right?
But it's so different because YouTube,
different.
You create a show and then you put it on YouTube. YouTube is a distribution medium for you. Facebook, this is why I might disagree with you, Kurt. I think Facebook does want to be a media company. I understand that their business is broader than that. But when you see them paying people, I think they want to incent people to, they want to be the place you go for information, for entertainment, for everything.
They want to be the platform for internet content for all their users.
And in fact, we know most people now get their news on Facebook. So don't you think maybe there's some – why – you said a couple of things that were provocative, I thought, Kurt. One is that Facebook can't keep paying them. Why not?
I just don't think that it's sustainable. You know, I think
– they got lots of money, don't they?
Sure. I guess perhaps sustainable is wrong. You're right. I mean, they could continue to pay. I don't think it's good business. So I think what they're going to be inspired to do or driven to do is say, okay, now that you've gotten on the platform, you're comfortable with how this works. You've seen the audience that we can drive because we're Facebook. And we should talk about the algorithm too, because that's a whole nother thing that I think Facebook has. YouTube does some of that, but I think this is Facebook's bread and butter, right? Is that they can basically show you what they want to show you. So let's set that aside for a second. But you get these, you know, publishers comfortable going live on Facebook, and then you say, all right, how can we both make money here so that we're not losing money on this content, you know, project, if you will. And
so they've already said that they're going to start paying producers for that content, but it's not
rolled
out.
Well, that's what they're doing now. But I think
but revenue split for all users as opposed to just paying celebrities. You know what I mean?
But revenue split's different. So we're going to put, that's what YouTube does, right? We're going to put ads on it and you get some of that money and we'll get the rest of it.
And I think that's what Facebook will ultimately.
That's what they want to do too.
End up doing. Yeah. They haven't.
So that might be the distinction between a media company and a social media company. Because if you're CBS, you pay people to make content to put on CBS that you can put ads around. CBS can't go to Louis C.K. and say, hey, we'll do a rev share with you. We'll put some ads on there and we'll give you 5%. That's not how it works. Is that, is it a media company if you do that? Is YouTube a media company? I don't know.
Yeah, we may be splitting hairs a little bit or at least, you know, identifying how, you know, confusing this whole thing is. Yeah. But I think the slight or subtle difference that I think about is like, traditionally, Facebook has preached that it's a platform, right? It is not the one creating any of this. Yes, it may be at this point even paying CNN, but it is not coming out and saying we're going to, you know, create a new show.
They don't want to be Netflix. They don't want to create originals.
Right. I think they want to host as much great content as they can because that's where they can sell advertising. But I don't think that they want to be seen as even though we all, you know, again, the algorithm, they choose what we see. They don't want us to think that they choose what they, you know, we see. They want us to think that everything in our newsfeed is there because it's tailored towards us. And you know, there's an almighty algorithm that picks this for us. But like Facebook is in control of all that. And it's very easy to forget that they have essentially a say in what succeeds and what fails on Facebook. And right now they want live video to succeed. And that's why it's doing so well.
Yeah, I mean, I go to Facebook, and it's Mother's Day, right? So the bulk of my feed is moms, people with their moms, pictures. So it's very much still that social network. It's an interesting idea, though. Does Facebook see that as not compelling? I mean,
they had a drop in shareability.
Well, that's right. People aren't sharing
last year.
Yeah, that's right.
So they saw a tremendous drop in how many people are sharing content and sharing photos and stuff. And so they're putting as far as I can tell, they're putting so much more effort into, you know, the kind of the 3D stuff and live video. And they've said as much as well.
So this is a response they're looking for people not sharing.
Exactly.
Well, Facebook wants to be indispensable, right? And they built their business on, in large part, sort of selling ads against everybody's personal comments and their connections to their family and things like that. And it's like, where do you grow from there? And, you know, every news article and the instant articles system that they've got now, every video that you might want to see, if it's all inside Facebook, then if you're a Facebook user, you know, why go anywhere else? And then they control every single thing that you see. That's great for Facebook.
Okay, so here's a time now where Facebook would like to say, we're a media company. Facebook is getting a lot of heat right now for, in effect, sponsoring the Republican National Convention. And there are even petitions going on, people saying, Google's doing it too, by the way. And Facebook's response to this is not, no, we're not supporting Donald Trump. We are a media company covering the convention. So now they want to be a media company, right?
When it's convenient.
Yeah.
When it's convenient. I think they want to be where the attention is because they make their money from advertising. Advertising needs eyeballs. They need focus and attention from people. And what better place than the Republican National Convention with Donald Trump front and center? You know, they won't say that they're supporting any one particular candidate. That would be horrible for business for them, but they're going to try to be everywhere. And this is a big place for them to be, for sure.
Yeah, and of course, Zuckerberg at F8, the developers conference, took time from his keynote to, without naming Donald Trump, slam Donald Trump.
Yeah.
So
not so subtly.
Yeah, we want to build bridges, not walls, something like that, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Little dig.
Yet, there are a number of people who say Facebook and Google should not be pumping money into the Republican National Convention at this point. That's an interest. I mean, Google's response is, well, we're also covering the Democrats. As is Facebook, but Facebook's going to have a lounge at the Republican National Convention, and presumably they're paying money. Now, I don't. they're paying for, in effect, a sponsorship, as opposed to, say, CBS, which is going to put a camera crews and reporters there, but isn't paying money to be a sponsor of the Republican National Convention. So there is a difference. I mean, I'm just an old school media type, I guess, but
probably. No, it's a blurring of the lines for sure. I mean, you look at and let's go ahead and set the politics aside and just look at entertainment more broadly, right? I mean, I think Facebook did an exclusive partnership with HBO. I'm trying to think what it was for. It was recently they did, you know, they were sponsoring like some kind of HBO red carpet for maybe Game of Thrones or something like that.
Right,
and, you know, I asked at the time and they told me, no, we're not paying for this. But I mean, those are the types of deals that they are, everyone's leaning on one another. People want Facebook there because they're going to be able to reach so many more people. Facebook wants to be there because they want the content that is going to bring people to newsfeed. And so some of these are paid, some are just, you know, handshake agreements, but it is becoming a very, again, confusing relationship, and it's hard to keep track of who's kind of the objective media versus the partnering media, and Facebook is right in the middle of it all.
I say, when it comes to politics, why don't nobody cover it?
Yeah, let's all walk away.
And then all of our problems are solved.
Yeah, I wish. Twitter is doing the same thing. Twitter bought, not very expensively, and they didn't get an exclusive, Thursday Night Football. That was $1 million a game. Mm-hmm. It's bizarre because I don't ever, I mean, I could see maybe if it was in Facebook, I could see Facebook live streaming, but I don't know how it fits in Twitter at all. But I think Twitter kind of wants to be a media company too.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, they're already putting, you know, their Periscopes into the feed itself. You can, you know, see GIFs inside the feed. You're going to be able to watch that stuff inside a feed embedded in your stream. You know, right. I mean, that's where they're going with that, I'm sure.
I think they need to build Periscope directly into the main app.
Oh, yeah. It's not integrated enough at all.
No, I think it's a missed opportunity at this point, right? I mean, to continue to – I think getting the streams in there is great. You're going to get more people to watch them. But, you know, I've been watching a live Periscope stream in my Twitter feed, and I've wanted to either jump in with even just like send a heart, you know, mm-hmm. the little like thing that they do, or comment or whatever it may be. And all of a sudden it's telling me to, you know, boot me over to the other app. And then you're going to lose
that content that happens within that time period that you have to hop on over. And then in the Periscope app, you can't click any of the links in their description. I mean, it's just not a...
It needs to be fully integrated, in my opinion. And I think they'll do that, right? I mean, I can't imagine. They go hand in hand so well. Twitter's focus on like live being there, the first ones, live events, and Periscope literally being live. So... I think it's just a matter of time, but I think that for now is my biggest beef with the live video stuff they're doing.
It does seem odd that you don't see Periscope in the moments section at least, mm-hmm. right? I mean, that's something CNN would run these Periscopes if they had them. I don't know why they're having
a hard time integrating all of that stuff because it was a company that they bought. It wasn't something they built from the ground up. But even the fact that you can have two different usernames between Twitter and Periscope. I do. I'm still stuck with Callie Lewis, even though they just, you know, announced the fact that they have the ability to change your username now. But you can wind up with two usernames, which is stupid because it's the same freaking company.
And they own Vine too, right?
Yes.
Right.
There's another lost opportunity. Twitter seems to be full of lost opportunities. Is Facebook video a threat to Periscope?
Oh, yeah.
Because the live stuff?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
It's a lot more heavyweight, but you can. I mean, if you're sitting there with an iPhone or an Android device, you can start streaming live just as you would in Periscope from any event. I don't know if people are doing that. It's so funny because you could do everything you do in Snapchat probably in Facebook, but people don't do it. They do they Snapchat. What? It's funny. I think there is some sort of thing going on where you go, well, no, this is appropriate for this tool and this is appropriate for this tool.
I think what you're finding is that people will really just choose one of them. And that's ultimately, that's all you really need anyway. But, you know, the two of them together, you're already seeing them push each other. Like Periscope just announced the fact that they are archiving their scopes. If you use the hashtag save within the description of your when you go live, that was pushed partly by Facebook and partly by the fact that Catch, which was a third party archiving service, went away because they lost funding. So you know, but you're seeing them kind of go back and forth between feature sets trying to compete with each other, which is great for the world of live video because that means we're going to have awesome capabilities with live video, right?
Do you think it'll ever happen that people will tune in a show on Facebook, like go to Facebook to watch something?
That's what we're doing with Facebook Live Daily.
That's what we're doing now. That's right. That's Facebook Live.
We've got full on production. Sorry, Kurt, I didn't mean to finish that. Like we've got full on, you know, just production like you do here on Twitch.
I think you're one of the few people doing that, actually.
Well, yeah, but we wanted to be first. So
yeah, no, I think that's really interesting. Yeah.
Sorry, Kurt, go ahead.
No, that's okay. I'm not fully sold that, you know, this is even, I'm not sold that live video is going to be a major thing in a year from now. And my concern around it is that I don't know if regular people, aka, you know, not brands, not media organizations, not people of influence, I don't think regular people have a lot of incentive to go live. And I also think that it's often boring to watch regular people go live.
It's boring to watch Ricky Gervais go live.
Yeah. And I think this whole hype around live video is just that. It's a hype, right? Like at first it was cool. It's like, oh, whoa, I can tune in. Right. And I can't believe it's like we're Skyping, but we're not Skyping. And, you know, this is totally different. And now I've rarely watched live video streams and say this is better than something that was, you know, produced for me and is high quality that I would rather, you know, I'd rather have to wait an hour, I guess, to see this well produced.
So, Kurt, I'll disagree with you on that a little bit. I think you're absolutely right. Yes, some of them are boring to watch, right? Like there are a lot of bad scopes and bad live videos out there. But the live streaming is so addictive for both the broadcaster and the viewer because there's that immediacy, there's that reaction to reaction of you know that there's no time delay, right? So it's completely addicting on both sides of the wall. And then the fact that, yeah, everybody and their mother is live streaming right now. And a year from now, maybe people are going to be used to it and they won't do it as much. But like any technology, everybody jumps on board, like really, you know, hardcore at the beginning. Everybody uses it to see what it does. And then over time, it will be kind of dedicated to the people who are using it for a purpose. And you will kind of see content curation happening, you know, within the different platforms. Yeah. And so I don't think that it'll just go away. Cause I think live streaming is here to stay. It started back in 2007, with Quick, if you remember that.
Yeah.
And you know, the technology wasn't there for it to keep continuing, but then we've got now it going really strong technology-wise, whatever. And then you know, it'll just kind of continue to grow in that form. But I don't think that it's just going to kind of dissipate in interest at all.
I agree with Kurt that I feel like the hey everybody, I'm on my phone, let me show you my cat kind of live video is not going to be able to hold people.
Come on.
But live cats are not as exciting as curated cats. And that's you said true. Curation. And I think that when you think of something like Twitter Moments, that is a huge difference, right? The idea that especially maybe for breaking news events or sporting events, when people are doing live video and you've got somebody who's actually like switching between them and giving you different perspectives, I think things could get really interesting there. And then the professionals doing it, but just sort of random people showing you things that aren't that interesting, I think, you know, I think people are going to lose their appetite for that. But I think if you put them all together in something like what Twitter is trying to do semi-successfully with Twitter Moments, I think you could get something interesting.
I think
I guess real quick, I should clarify. I don't think it's going to disappear, right? I think it's just one of those things that if you hear people talk about it now, it really feels like live is the future, and that all of a sudden, you know, someday we're all going to be broadcasting live all the time, or that that's going to be the main way that we consume. I think that it'll be around. I just think that it'll be one of many media types that we use, and it will be a very specific media type, right? Like I may tune in live for, you know, I live in San Francisco. There's a parade going on, and I just kind of want to get a feel for like, hey, what's happening at the parade, or what's happening down the street? There's a fire, or there's an event of, you know, new significance that I want to tune into. I just don't think that it's going to be as big of a mainstream product use case that it seems to be taking off right now.
One of the reasons Facebook probably wants to do it, and it's one of the reasons Instagram is doing it, is because you can also do video ads. Kurt, you wrote about this in Recode. Instagram's encouraging users, they increase the length of videos to 1 minute, and they're encouraging users to post more videos in Instagram. I don't really think of Instagram as a video platform. I like stills on Instagram, but I am seeing more videos, and now we're seeing video ads. I saw that ad over and over again. The Google ad of, who was it? Anyway, it kept showing.
Yeah.
What'll get really interesting is when Facebook Live and Periscope allow you to monetize while you're live.
In the ad. Right? Well, you can in Facebook Live, can't you? Didn't they say that you could run an ad in your stream and monetize?
You can do native or you know, brand marketing, essentially. Right.
So I could do one of our style ads in there. And I keep all the revenue.
I think
right?
so. Yeah. I believe you can.
I'm pretty sure because we noted that with interest. I thought because YouTube won't let me do that.
YouTube should let you do that too.
No, I don't. Well,
there's a whole brand marketing.
Yeah, they want to sell. YouTube wants to sell all the ads.
Well, but they allow you to do your own stuff within that.
I'm just talking about YouTube Live. If we stream this show live on YouTube. It was my understanding we can't because we have ads in this show, and YouTube didn't sell them and doesn't have a cut of them. We put all our content on YouTube and they've never pulled it down, even on Red, which is interesting because that's supposedly ad free. So I don't know if YouTube is uniformly enforcing those rules or not. I have no idea.
Facebook, you can boost after the fact. But if you could boost a live video while you're live, that could have a tremendous.
Oh, you mean buying a Facebook ad for your live video?
Yeah. Correct. Yeah. And then also, you know, like you were talking about, having that within kind of host endorsements like you do here and within the ads themselves. I know Facebook is looking into all of that stuff, and I don't think they've settled on any one particular path. And I think they'll probably try a couple of things over the course of the next year.
Yeah. Let's take a break. Let's test this theory and do an ad. Kurt Wagner is here from Recode. It's great to have you. His first time on Twit. So be gentle, everybody. Be nice.
Thank you. He's awesome.
I know. He's great. And love having you, Luria Petrucci. Her new enterprise, geeksuniversity.com, has a live stream. She's still on Geeks Life. I see you everywhere now. good for you. In her new digs, in her new studio up in the Seattle area.
Portland.
Very different. Did you move there for tax reasons?
No. Okay. I moved because I never wanted to settle in Texas in the first place. Oh. And I had an opportunity to make a change. And
I'm thinking about Oregon myself because there's no income tax up there.
No sales tax, I don't think.
Yeah. How do they make money?
They do. We have some kind of tax here. I don't know.
Sure, you do.
I moved here like 6 months ago, I think, seven months ago, and I haven't really paid any attention.
and also from sixcolors.com, Jason Snell. He and I are the old school media types.
Yeah.
The blogging and the podcasting.
Writing, those old audio. Things. We got to add some video things. In. We got a face for podcasting, I guess.
Our show today brought to you by Braintree. Well, no matter what, if you're doing an app or you've got a website and you want to take payments, there is one way to do it. Braintree Payments. The nice thing about Braintree, it's an easy integration for you. It's about 10 lines of code. As a developer, you just paste the code in. You get a control panel at Braintree, and you can decide what forms of payment you can take. When a new one comes out, you check the box, and boom, you're in. It's magic. You can take everything from pounds to PayPal, from pesos to credit cards, all the currencies, Bitcoin, Apple Pay, Android Pay, everything, Venmo. It's a full-stack payment platform. It's easily adapted to whatever is new, makes your users happy. And by the way, your users are familiar with it because they use it all the time on Uber, on Lyft, Airbnb, hotels tonight. Even GitHub uses Braintree. So why aren't you using Braintree? Easy, secure payments. Code for you is simple. It works with Android, iOS, and JavaScript. In .NET, Node.js, Java, Perl, PHP, Python, and Ruby. The code is elegant. The documentation is clear. And it's a win for everybody. Fast payouts. And your customers will appreciate the security. Ever use those buyable pins on, you know, through Pinterest? That's Braintree. You use Braintree probably every day because they're everywhere. BraintreePayments.com/twit. Try them today. Your first $50,000 in payments fee-free when you go to BraintreePayments.com/twit. I'm just watching Periscope streams, and you're right. It's really boring. They have a teleport button where you just get a random stream. But it feels like there's so much potential. Everybody was so excited about this. And Meerkat, Meerkat's gone. They've pivoted. I'm looking at a fence. Oh, wow. It looks like a tornado or a storm's coming.
It's a live fence.
That
fence is happening right now.
Yeah.
Don't muck the puddle.
You're looking live at a fence. How about that? Does it feel better now?
It feels like network television, actually. Yeah. I'm standing out here in a field for no apparent reason.
Again, nothing happening right now.
Nothing happening. There was a tornado here some time ago.
Fence is still standing.
And there will be one again soon.
And there will be another one any moment. You know what I will always tune in to watch live? SpaceX sticking the landing. Oh, man, that's two in a row.
And it looks like
look at that. These are, of course, the rockets that put the satellite in orbit or went to the ISS resupply. And is this the launch or the landing?
That's the landing.
That looks like a launch in reverse.
Yeah, that's it exactly. They landed on that drone ship, and that was a tough one. They gave it like a 50-50 chance of making it.
It's very impressive.
It's got three engines and boosting something to orbit and then having to slow down and return back to that ship.
Look, they have young Gen Y hosts.
Oh, yeah, they are really media savvy. Those are, I believe, all SpaceX employees, but they've got, they've been media trained and they host their webcast. And then for the real nerds, they have a technical webcast that is just like rocket scientists wearing. That's more of your Apollo 13 webcast. It's a lot of mission control and all that. Or you can watch the one with the genial hosts.
You know, when you see Elon at work and you realize it's possible to do everything right, to market it right, to do the science right, to the technology right, it's so impressive. And then you wonder what's going on with Twitter. Like, is it just a really limited supply of brain cells out there? Is Elon so much better than everybody else? He just seems to be firing on every cylinder.
Leo, you know this better than anybody. It's all media and how you control the mistakes that don't get seen.
Well, he
right?
knows that though. Really, he really knows about. But it's more than that. I mean, he's technically brilliant. What they're doing at Tesla and SpaceX and Solar City is technically brilliant. It's marketed perfectly. The message is on point, and it's just very impressive when you see somebody who can stick it. He's the Olympian of this. And you're right. He does not ignore the very important marketing end of it. You know, just getting the video out there. Be one thing to say, oh, yeah, SpaceX landed another rocket at sea. Another thing to see that video.
Well, NASA, I hope they're paying attention to how, because NASA's tried some things with social
NASA's
media outreach. I've done a couple of
this.
NASA socials, but the live stream production for SpaceX, I've been really impressed by. Right. Like they are putting on the whole production in a way that I think NASA relied on the networks to do that back when the networks covered
them. Walter Cronkite
did it. But NASA's video feeds now are really dry. They definitely feel like video feeds from a large government bureaucracy. And then you see SpaceX and you're like, oh yeah, they get it. They get like modern internet video and why you want to be entertaining while you're showing off your launch of this. Because rocket launches are fun for the moments when the rocket is launching, but SpaceX goes all out in terms of explaining what's going to happen and, you know, piping in the applause from the audience that they've invited to show that, live. I mean it's showmanship on there too, yeah.
You know who else gets it? Donald Trump gets it. I think if you're going to get elected president going forward, you better get it. Right, you better get how to use the media to your great effect. Trump didn't have to buy many ads or any ads.
Yeah. Elon Musk calls; he wants an apology for comparing him to Donald Trump.
Yeah, seriously.
Bad news. That's the key, isn't it? If you're going to succeed in the future, you need to know how to pull all of these strings, and in politics too.
The live stream of the deep sea, the deepest point in the ocean, from the submersible.
No, that's cool.
Yeah. So they went down in a submersible to the, what's that?
The Marianas Trench.
Yes. And they live streamed the entire thing going down and seeing all of these crazy looking animals down there. You know, things that you would never see kind of up towards the surface. So I thought that was pretty interesting as well.
It could be Sheena Ebu's. It could be hawks in their nests. It could be the Marianas Trench. This is the Okeanos Explorer 2016. And it's not, okay, it's not gripping.
It kind of was in the moment. Like, we watched it around here. And, I mean, it's, you definitely kind of have to be certain kind of geek.
It's like NASA TV, though. It's space exploration, right?
And they had good hosts, too. I mean, there were certain moments where it was like, wait, what is going on over there? What is that, you know?
Right. That is kind of neat.
A remarkable find. Cool. Coral species that occurs here as well as in the Hawaiian Islands, which is halfway across the Pacific.
They're really doing this like NASA, though. It's really, it's really interesting. I mean, why not? It's the same kind of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, it's I just can't. I just don't know if I'd tune in, guys. I'm sorry.
Well, I knew. You know what? Okay, I'll admit it. I knew about it. Didn't tune in.
Yeah. I mean, I like the idea a lot. When you were describing it, I was actually like, oh, that's a perfect use case of live video. And then now that we're actually watching the the footage, I'm a little disappointed. I'm a little disappointed.
It's soothing, Kurt. It's very soothing.
It's very soothing.
It is soothing.
Make some tea.
You guys ever watch Planet Earth or Blue?
Love that. Oh, yeah. BBC Planet Earth. Like, it's really.
I'd be willing to wait for them to compile this into Planet Earth.
Sure. You know what's sad? They made Planet Earth in 1080p. At the time, that was like, this is as good as it needs to be. Yeah. And now they have to reshoot. They're reshooting it all. They've cost a huge amount of money to make in the first place. They're reshooting it all in 4K. Oh, and you know what? Really? By the time they finish that, it'll be 8K. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, they'll have to do it again.
Yeah. You know, I think I think live also, but Kurt makes a good point. Live is also a niche audience for something that then you dress up and reach a broader audience with. And that's fine. That's the one of the great things about having internet video is you can have a live stream that appeals to 5,000 people and then an edited version that appeals to 50,000 people. And then maybe there's a TV special that goes to 500,000 people. And that's all good.
Totally. I think live has... It's going to have its audience and it's going to have its uses. I just, again, to repeat, I just don't think it's going to be the thing that we all do.
Wow. Well, I mean, I think it has to play a part in, you know, if you're any kind of media, you know, company or doing any kind of, if you're doing YouTube videos, you should be doing live. You know, you should be integrating that into what you do. You're never going to reach a massive audience without rebroadcasting that, just like you were saying, you know. But it's because of the I mean Leah, you've been doing live and everybody in the chat
room. I feel like such a slacker though compared to all of these people. I feel like I'm just lazy. I should really be doing a better job of
I saw somebody say earlier they want to see you on Periscope. So
yeah, they've seen me on Periscope. Yeah. It was embarrassing.
But how long?
I mean, I think it's
I've used Facebook Live too. I like Facebook Live, but the kind of stuff we do is really a little more like this Marianas Trench than it is. It's very relaxing.
You can clip that up and put some really good, like, upbeat music to it and put
Oh, we do that. It's called a promo.
Yeah. Exactly.
Actually, you want to take a look? Look, this is what we this little show and tell. If you missed anything this week on Twit, here's what it looked like. Much more interesting than it actually was, by the way, but go ahead and watch the
Previously promo. On Twit.
Alex could do the Wookiee.
You can do a whole podcast in Wookiee.
The new screensavers.
Wait a minute. I'm having a flashback. I thought for a moment that was Kate Batello standing here. Oh, my God. That's a long time ago.
Oh, I know. Look.
And we were so blurry back then.
Tech news today.
Google has been feeding some interesting text to an AI engine to make it smarter.
Now it's moved on to a project where it's fed over 2,800 romance novels to its AI engine to make it a more conversational. Yeah, that image.
Well, you did put it at the top of the article.
This Week in Law.
Mark has written perhaps the best legal brief ever, much of it in Klingon.
The fun thing is, it does shape the way you have to think about things. How the heck do you say intellectual property law in Klingon when there is no word for intellectual?
Twit. Twit with your head, not over it.
We also have This Week in Law translated into Klingon.
Kastavis chut ok.
Love it. Oh, my God. I have to get on that program. It looks so awesome.
Oh, it's a great show. It's all about law in Klingon. We have a great week coming up. Jason Howell has the week ahead.
Thanks a lot, Leo. Here's a look at a few things we're going to be keeping an eye on in the week ahead. Oracle and Google are actually set to return to court on Monday, May 9th, in a retrial of Oracle's copyright suit, charging Google use Java in Android without a license. We can expect to see Larry Ellison and Eric Schmidt to take the stand once again. On Monday, May 9th, also, TechCrunch Disrupt New York kicks off, and one thing to look out for is the unveiling of the highly anticipated Viv AI assistant. It's created by the ex-founding members of the Siri team. They claim Viv is what Siri was supposed to be before Apple bought the company and made the technology their own. A few earnings reports to follow, with Electronic Arts and Nokia reporting on May 10th and NVIDIA reporting on May 12th. And you know what? I'm guessing plenty more tech news will break all week long. So catch Megan Maroney and I on Tech News Today at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, 12 a.m. UTC at twit.tv/live. That's a look at the week ahead. Back to you, Leo.
Thank you, Jason Howell. Every Wednesday through Friday, got to watch it. Actually, that Oracle Google trial is interesting. I interviewed James Gosling a couple of weeks ago, creator of Java.
Yeah.
And he said, we, you know, in Sun, we really thought that, you know, what was going on was that what Google was doing with Android was slimy. He said, no, the whole issue comes down to whether Google's implementation of Java, Dalvik, was a ripoff of Java. They tried to license Java, then declined after, I don't know, something went wrong, and wrote something that was identical. But he was of the opinion, it wasn't exactly clean room. He said, if you look at the code, it's pretty obvious that they slimed us, was the phrase Gosling. But Gosling said, we never, you know, were willing to go to court over it. Jonathan Schwartz, the last CEO at Sun, who oversee the sale to Oracle, wasn't willing to take on Google. But Larry Ellison sure as heck was. Then the interesting thing, and I thought this was, he said, but the lawyers, once they got to the case, decided that there wasn't really a case they could argue about stealing the code. So the cases ended up being against something that Gosling thinks is a terrible precedent, which is copywriting an
APIs,
API.
Yeah.
And he's dead set against that. So what Oracle is saying is that Google didn't copy the Java code. They copied the Java API. That's provable because that's how you make compatible code. You have to copy the API. So we're going to – this, as you may remember, this case – ended and it's back again. And now Oracle, it wants $9 billion in damages from Google.
What if they do the case in Klingon? I think that would be more entertaining for all of us.
Wow. Really? The first trial was a win for Google. The judge found that APIs are not eligible for copyright, but the Court of Appeals overturned it. And the Court of Appeals said APIs are creative works. APIs. This is not the code. This is the... description of what the code should be looking for, what you should say to the code so that you can talk to the code, that also is creative. It's unfortunate. This is the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit. Google petitioned the Supreme Court. Google got support from Yahoo, HP, Red Hat, open source advocates, Microsoft, EMC, and NetApp on the other side said you should let the Federal Circuit ruling stand. The Supreme Court did. They rebuffed the appeal. And now it's back to the jury because even though the court said that the APIs are copyrighted, it didn't say which or how the use of the 37 APIs in question was fair use.
What a mess.
So imagine this. We just found 12 people off the street and we're going to ask them.
Well, isn't that the problem with a lot of the law involving technology today is it's not necessarily even that you can't prove something. It's that can you get a jury and quite honestly, can you get attorneys and judges and juries to understand some of these incredibly technical and esoteric things? It's really a tough job to do that. And then invested in everything that they're judging, they're also judging these companies, that this is Oracle run by Larry Ellison and it's this huge Google, and how you keep that out of your mind if you're a juror while also understanding all the technical details. Yeah. I don't know. And this is why there's weird law when it comes to cutting edge tech stuff, is that, you get strange rulings by people who often don't understand everything about what's going on.
Joe Mullen, who's writing about this in Ars Technica, said a big Oracle win could be an extinction level event for small companies who can't fight these court cases.
It's another battering ram for people who are trying to create compatible software where the company that made the baseline, the platform, is not willing to work with them.
Right.
This, by copywriting APIs, you could mash out a whole sector of people who are trying to make compatible
software. We wouldn't have a PC industry if Phoenix and Compaq and others hadn't been able to duplicate the functionality of IBM's BIOS without actually duplicating the code. Right. They were able to. They made the PC compatible industry. And thanks to that, we have a personal computer industry. Otherwise, it would be IBM dominating this still.
Yeah, so with the APIs, we're basically saying, can you copyright the compatibility with our thing? And that's, I get why Gosling would say that that's the problem, is he feels like Google did do a slimy thing, right?
Right.
But this is the wrong way to do it.
This,
but
this is the outcome only legal no recourse. One wants. Yeah, he said this is the lawyers talking. This is what they felt would be a case that was winnable. And you know what? I guess they weren't far wrong. They're doing okay so far. Brazil, speaking of court. In Brazil, of course, this was earlier in the week, and it's WhatsApp was shut down by a single judge in Brazil who said the judge was mad that WhatsApp was encrypted and that Facebook wasn't helping. And decided to shut down WhatsApp for 72 hours. It's not the first time it's happened. The last time it happened, a higher court overruled the judge. Same thing happened. Marcel Maia Montalvo of a small town in the state of Sergipe, 2 months ago, he put Facebook's vice president for Latin America in jail for failure to cooperate with a subpoena issued as part of a criminal investigation. They want the content of WhatsApp. And, of course, after that, it wasn't very much longer after that WhatsApp just announced, we're going to encrypt everything. It's just all encrypted. We can't see it anymore. That hasn't held back the Brazilian courts. They shut it down for 12 hours, and then, again, the higher court came in and said, you know what? There's 100 million people. 93% of all adults in Brazil use WhatsApp. I think you're turning it back on. That's the power of the market.
The guy that was arrested... The big issue, I mean, multiple issues with just arresting an executive on his way to work. But I was told at the time, I mean, he was a Facebook executive, not a WhatsApp executive.
Right.
And I know that WhatsApp is owned by Facebook, but like not even involved in the product or business in any way. So you can imagine that ruffled some feathers on the Facebook side of things.
Yeah.
Not happy about it.
The judge said the arrest was justified by Facebook's repeatedly failing to comply with judicial orders. But it wasn't Facebook, as you say. It was WhatsApp.
Yeah. I mean, it's owned, of course, right? And I think I think these issues are certainly concerning for Facebook as they move. I mean, they spent a lot of money on WhatsApp, right? $19 billion,
yeah,
I believe.
But it's not going to just be Facebook or WhatsApp. That's the good news. If they're going to court, they're going to court with a lot of other companies and people.
Totally. Yeah, it's the trend towards total privacy, total encryption. And you're right, as shortly before this incident, but after the last one, was when they formally announced they had rolled out end-to-end encryption for all of their WhatsApp users. But, I mean, they've been close to that for some time now. So especially now, all the messages you're sending on WhatsApp, they exist on your phone and the person's phone you sent them to. And that is really angering these governments that want more control and they want to be able to see what people are talking about.
It angers me that the governments are having a problem with the fact that I want to say what I want to say and nobody else should be able to read it. I mean, come on.
It's happening here in the U.S., but that's the point. It's happening all over the world. It's happening to everybody. In fact, this Feinstein-Burr bill, which, of course, is the Senate attempt to it's very sneaky because it doesn't say ban encryption. It doesn't say even provide a backdoor. It just says any company served with a judicial order, a legitimate judicial order, must provide the information the court order is asking for. But, of course, the implication is, as geeks, as we understand it, is, well, that means you can't either have to have a backdoor or you can't have encryption because WhatsApp can't provide that information and they would be liable under Feinstein-Burr. And now Julian Sanchez, writing for the Cato Institute, says that would actually ban your browser because your browser has SSL built into it. And you can't go to Google and say, hey, what was Jason Snell looking at last night? Because it's an SSL site. What's his banking information? You can't. So this bill, which as far as I know is still flying high, would literally make HTTPS, TLS security, illegal. Because no company could then provide that information to a court order.
We're in a very risky spot right now, I feel like, you know? I mean, I'm sure you guys have talked about it quite a bit over the course of the last
few months, bringing it up again and again and again. Because it's not going away.
And it's partly our fault as consumers and as geeks, right? Like, because we get so excited by all these new technologies that can do this and can do that, and we can, you know, do cool new things, and we give away our privacy without even thinking about it in favor of a cool new technology, you know? And I mean, I do it too, but it's something that I think starts with us as consumers and geeks.
Yes, but are you going to want to stand up and say, and by the way, law enforcement shouldn't have any tools to fight crime, to fight terrorism? Should they be unable to wiretap? Should there be communication?
Well, if you really look at it, I mean, what they're using all these tools for is not what they claim, you know? I mean, so that's a whole other discussion. It's not being used really to protect us like they want us to think it is. So, you know, I mean, it is a complicated subject for sure.
Yeah.
I'm curious what you guys think. Whose responsibility is it, right? I mean, does Facebook or WhatsApp in this case have a responsibility for how their platform is used, or who else?
Right. Who else?
Who else is responsible? I don't know.
Isn't it provocative for WhatsApp to just put encryption in all of a sudden and say, neener, neener, neener?
I mean,
well, I'm sure they're not saying neener, neener, neener.
Yeah.
But they might be thinking
it. Fantastic if they actually were.
Can't encrypt it. Never can.
Right.
Never will.
Ha 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 ha. I think the timing was certainly. Probably not ideal for folks who think that they're doing this just to stoke the fire. But again, they had been working on this for some time. So it's not as if the initial Brazil ban happened and they said, okay, we're going to get back at them by end-to-end encrypting everything on the app. You know, that was already in the works. So the timing probably looks worse than it really is. My guess is, you know, the whole reason they ran into this issue before was that they were halfway done or more encrypting everything, and that's why they weren't able to hand over messages to begin with, right? So I think the encryption happened before the incident, and then the encryption got completed and it was just, it looks a little bit more menacing or malicious.
Let's not forget that one of the candidates for the president of the United States, at least one of the candidates, said, quote, "To think that Apple won't allow us to get into that cell phone, who do they think they are? We need to take back the internet from terrorists." That's Donald Trump. Actually, I think if you, before you vote for somebody in any election, you might want to ask, what's your position on encryption? I should find out what Clinton's position is on encryption.
I want my Facebook and my WhatsApp and my whatever services I use to encrypt my stuff. You know, I mean, and I don't even do anything bad. But at the same time, like there was, have you guys ever watched that? I think it was a documentary, Terms and Conditions something. It has terms and conditions in it. It's like.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And in the, like some guy, some journalist, no, a writer for a TV show, actually gets arrested or something because he looked up how to yes. murder your wife.
Right.
Because he was writing a drama series about right. where that happened in an episode. Right. So, I mean, all that stuff can be taken out of context and bad things can happen. Like, so. I personally want my stuff encrypted.
I don't know if privacy is the right angle, or it's one angle, but the other angle, of course, is security. And the problem is if, you know, this is what protects us from hackers as well, not just from the government. This is what protects us from bad guys. Yeah,
these are security features. And let's also forget this is math, and you can't outlaw math. And the bad guys...
Oh, you can try.
You can try, but the bad guys are going to use the math.
You saw the Ivy League professor was kicked. It was almost kicked off an American Airlines flight for doing math.
For doing math, yeah. We've got to stop this epidemic of math on airplanes.
Wait, what is this?
Okay, he's a professor of economics at the University of Pennsylvania. He's Italian, but he does have a beard, so he could be an Arab. I don't know. And he was writing math equations on a piece of paper while waiting for his American Airlines flight to take off. A passenger sitting next to him looked over there, said, "Those look like, that looks like Arabic." Got up, told the flight attendant the plane was delayed on the tarmac for 30 minutes. The economist was removed from the aircraft and questioned by airport security. And the woman who turned him in never got back on the plane. He was allowed to get back on the plane. The plane didn't take off.
It sounds like the airline people were pretty embarrassed about this because they realized that he was a professor and it was math and that she had
they
faked.
They could see it.
I think the report I read said she faked being sick because she was worried about him, and she apparently just walked away.
Yeah. After reviewing the situation, a spokesman for American Airlines said the captain determined the flight should continue. We apologize to our customers. They never did find the woman who turned him in. He's a nice looking fella. He's a Italian.
Yeah.
That's practically a terrorist.
Yes. Well,
I think, I don't
it's
know.
Curly
if
hair and olive
curly
skin.
Curly hair,
doing
olive
math.
Skin.
Watch out.
He's got a beard doing
Wait,
math.
I'm
you know where math
Italian.
Comes from.
Hang on. I'm half Italian. This
okay.
is not
yeah,
a
no,
sign.
I am too. I'm a quarter of Italian.
Math was largely invented in the Arab world.
That's right.
So.
It's called algebra for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Let's take a break.
The world we live in.
It is the world we live in. Sad to say. Our show brought to you by the way, great panel. Great to have you. Kurt Wagner is here from Recode.net, newly recast, looking great,
yes.
looking sharp.
Thank you. Thank you.
Nice
go look at check Recode.net. It's, you've shown a few of our stories on the broadcast so far,
I
still
Recode.
Get used to it. You show it, and I'm like, hey, that looks pretty sharp.
That's my story, but I know it doesn't look like what I thought it used
doesn't
to look like.
Doesn't look like what I saw before.
No, Recode is absolutely a go-to every single day for me. I read it religiously.
Thank you.
As I do sixcolors.com, Jason Searle's wonderful Mac-focused. I don't want to call it a blog. That sounds demeaning.
It's my website. It's an independent site.
It's an independent publication.
Yeah, sure.
On the internet.
Sounds good.
And Luria Petrucci, you may remember as Callie Lewis for so long at Geeks Life and now geeksuniversity.com. Great to have you as well. And yes.
Thanks.
She does math, and she's Italian, so watch out.
I'm just going to put it out there. I just use my phone's calculator. I don't write down math.
Our show today brought to you by The Place I Blog, Squarespace. And I might have a blog, although it could be a publication, actually. Squarespace has recently unveiled some beautiful magazine-style templates for people who want to do publications. Grid-style landing pages will allow you to see all the posts in one place. It's got that infinite scroll now that everybody's doing where you just keep going. So, you know, it's not paged. You've got related posts at the bottom encouraging visitors to explore more. There's author profiles, search field right in the header. It is perfect if you want to create a publication. But, you know, Squarespace is perfect no matter what you wanted to do on the web. If you're a photographer and you want a portfolio, if you're a business, we just, you know, our new business, Artisanal, we just created our Squarespace site. My blog, leolaporte.com, that's on Squarespace. I started with a cover page. I love the cover page feature because you could put your images there and it's full bleed. It, you know, the template I use, it goes all the way to the edge. So it really is great. And then I put my blog there and the blogging tools are fantastic. I actually, this last post I just put up, I emailed to Squarespace. It made it so easy. I just blogged by emailing. I love that. Squarespace is also great if you want to sell. They've got fantastic e-commerce. In fact, it's one of the few places where your store really looks a piece of your website. It's the same design and everything. It's not just something hanging off your website. Now, members who have built or contribute to three or more active Squarespace websites have access to something new. It's called Squarespace Circle. Circle membership includes advanced guides, optimized support, six-month trial periods for new projects. Wow, 6 months and a lot more. They want to really thank the people who use Squarespace a lot. And you'll also appreciate that they're now a domain registrar. If you are wanting to make a website, you know, some of these domain registrars, they put the holding page, and it's the worst. It's embarrassing. You'll get a Squarespace page when you get your domain name from Squarespace Domains, a clean, spam-free parking page. So you don't have to start building right away. It's just awesome. Squarespace Domains, more than 200 top-level domain names, designations are available there. It's a really nice registrar. And it looks as good as Squarespace does. Squarespace is the best. For hosting, for software, now for domain registration, squarespace.com. Make sure you use the offer code TWIT to get 10% off and show your support for This Week in Tech. We're all in on the Squarespace. All right, Callie, you're from Texas, or were.
Luria.
Luria. Callie, Luria.
It's okay.
Callie's from Texas. Luria's from Portland. I understand.
Right.
Yeah. And they're both from Italy. Go figure that.
Oh, weird.
Uber and Lyft support, this is so confusing to me, supported Proposition 1, put $8 million into campaigning it. Proposition 1 lost by a wide margin. Proposition 1 was to eliminate regulations the city wanted to impose on Uber and Lyft, fingerprint registration, things like that. I think regulations that aren't a bad idea. 10,000 drivers are going to lose their job now because they lost, and Uber and Lyft said, bye-bye, Austin.
Wow.
Bye-bye, Austin. You don't want us. They have vowed to stop operating in Austin on Monday morning, and Uber says that'll put about 10,000 drivers for both companies out of work. They didn't get their way on Proposition 1.
And Uber was using all those cool, like, they were doing the pedal stuff as well, I believe. In
Austin. That's right. Remember that? That's right. Yeah. I took a pedicab at South By, an Uber pedicab. I don't know if that's like, was that just for South By or?
I think they were doing it like long term for just not just South By. Maybe I'm wrong, but I guess this leaves it open for a new company to come into town. I mean, Austin's not a bad place to kind of start to chink away at Uber and Lyft if they're going to leave.
Kind of wonder why they're against civic regulation. I mean, were they onerous regulations? Were they impossible for Uber to live up to that the city wanted to? I mean, I understand it's complicated because a lot of times a city will have incumbent cab companies that lobby hard against Uber and Lyft coming in. And so maybe the Austin City Council wanted to do something that would be hard on Uber and Lyft. So I should ask for more details on this. But it does seem like Uber and Lyft came in with $8 million and said, no, you don't want that. They circulated petitions, 60,000 signatures.
Can you imagine? I always am shocked when I think about the regulatory, you know, red tape that Uber, Lyft, Airbnb, I mean, they're dealing with this stuff in like every city in the world.
Yeah.
And I can't even imagine working on one of those legal teams at one of those companies. Like, how you keep it straight and how you keep your energy up. I mean, they must be dealing with lawsuits and
constantly. Yeah,
every day.
Where a lot of their money goes. So here's what happened. The Austin City Council in December passed 9-2 an ordinance aimed at regulating Uber and Lyft more like traditional taxi companies. 5 hours of debate, the council voted to require drivers for vehicle-to-hire apps like Uber and Lyft to pass fingerprint-based background checks. Uber and Lyft at the time said, we're going to leave if you do that. The ordinance started in February 1st, but it was a 12-month phase-in, so there was time, and Uber and Lyft decided, we're going to see if we can get the community up in arms against this. We want to self-regulate.
Sure they do. Doesn't this sound a little bit like a professional sports team threatening to move if you don't build them a new stadium?
Yeah.
It's like they're just holding the city hostage because they figure they've got them over a barrel. They're not going to they're going to relent because everybody's going to be grumpy about this high profile thing. But I agree with Luria. I think this is an opportunity, right? For competitors maybe. Or if Austin is that attractive, then they'll be back.
Uber
Although
said
I don't know that. I mean, I think if I'm understanding it correctly, and I haven't researched this story at all, but if Uber is saying no because their drivers don't want to be fingerprinted, then competition would have the same problem then, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, and so what I'm not clear on, I'm trying to understand this, is if taxi companies have the same requirements. In other words, if taxi drivers have the same
fingerprinting
requirements.
I think they do.
I think this just makes Uber and Lyft the same kind of regulations. Uber said we won't be able to get drivers. This begs the question of why. They won't be able to get drivers if they're required to get fingerprints. We won't be able to sign up drivers. And Lyft said we do not operate in any market that requires the drivers to be fingerprinted.
I want my, the chat room is talking about Uber wanting to be different, but I want Uber to be different. I don't enjoy taxi car rides. I enjoy Uber.
Well, taxi drivers now are seeing this now in the chat room, and I think it's probably accurate. Somebody says in Austin, you do have to be fingerprinted and background checked to be a taxi driver. Why should Uber and Lyft be any different?
I mean, where did the original, law come from for taxi car drivers that they had to do that? I mean,
according to Austin Police Chief Art Acevedo, a lot of sexual assaults happen in the city of Austin,
which Uber has had to deal with. And that's why what is it? Chariot for Women is starting to come out.
Yeah, but then they're going to get sued out of existence instantly because they don't pick up men. They have female drivers and female riders. And of course, that's, some say, discrimination. I think it's a great idea, frankly. I would encourage, if there were a Chariot around here, I would encourage my daughter to use it. I think most drivers are harmless. I'm not saying that, that something about being a driver attracts a bad class of people.
I mean, Jason and Luria, you guys mentioned, competitor jumping. I mean, do you really think at this point there's going to be anyone besides Uber and Lyft getting into this space? And I realize that's, I'm probably going into a horrible trap right now by saying no one could ever go against Uber and Lyft, but the amount of money they've spent, the progress they've made, we've already talked about all the legal hurdles that they're constantly going through. I just can't imagine anyone else would want to get into this.
I know in New York there are many competing companies.
Really?
Yeah. And even the taxi companies in New York now have apps, and there are multiple apps. I mean, clearly people look at Uber as a very successful unicorn and say, boy, I'd like to get some of those billions in my pocket.
I could see a company coming in, especially into, I don't know if Austin would fly with this, but I could see a company coming into a place that Uber and Lyft are not. And if they focus on the customer service, customer safety issue, everybody is background checked. But at the same time, we're still better than taxis, and we our cars are clean. You're not going to get stinky, backseat rides. I could actually see somebody coming in and doing that. I know that a lot of people have an issue with the fact that you don't know who you're getting with Uber. I I've never had any types of problems, and I don't really walk in fear of doing that, right? Like, I'm not going to not do something just because I don't know who it is.
I'm wondering if the issue is that Uber is attracting, given that these are border areas, undocumented immigrants who don't want to go through a background check because they can't, and but who would otherwise drive. Not that they're unsafe people.
You couldn't get a license, though, probably.
Well, that's right. They have to have a driver's license. Right.
Yeah, I would imagine.
Uber uses and Lyft uses third-party background checks. The city of Houston, for instance, says we're not thrilled about these because they don't catch every criminal. In fact, Houston has required fingerprints, and there have been at least several cases where drivers who passed a background check were then incriminated by their fingerprint because their fingerprint was in a criminal database somewhere. So, it's a complex thing because there's also the issue of traditional yellow cab companies. Both Austin and Houston are limited in how many vehicles they can have, the medallion system.
Right, and we deal with that in San Francisco, too. And That's why these companies are big in the Bay Area, because the city of San Francisco kind of blew it.
There aren't very many cabs. And those medallions are in New York, a medallion's worth $1 million.
Right.
And that's an artificial way to keep the demand high.
I keep hearing about this medallion thing, and I don't actually have any idea what that is.
It's a license to have a cab.
Right. Why is it worth $1 million?
Because it's not that the cab drivers are buying medallions, but investors buy medallions and have fleets of cabs.
Because they're limited. There's a limited quantity,
and it keeps it limited, and it keeps it more valuable because you don't want 1 million cabs on the street. There are other reasons. I mean, New York traffic is terrible. And I know some New Yorkers say it's because of all the Uber and Lyft vehicles, although there was a study commissioned by the city of New York that came out last couple of weeks ago that said, no, it's not Uber. That's not the cause of it. It's, you know what, this is a complex issue, but I do feel like passenger safety has got to be paramount.
I think they're afraid of the precedent that they're going to have to do this everywhere. And so they'd rather at least threaten to walk away from a market. Although, again, if that market is worth it to them, one or both of them will come back to
it.
Right?
Yeah, they haven't left Houston, which also requires fingerprinting. And no one's sure why. Maybe it's a better market for them. I don't know.
I'd be curious to know what the percentage of issues that both Lyft and Uber have had. I've heard that they have had issues, but I don't have any idea what percentage of people are complaining, or, you know, is it a tiny, tiny, tiny percentage? Because it doesn't seem like a big issue.
Do you feel afraid as a young woman? Do you feel afraid of taking
I actually have been more scared in the back of a cab for my safety than I have with any Uber driver.
Right.
Like, I have had tremendously good experiences with Uber versus cabs. And that's why I always choose that if I can.
Yeah, I encourage my daughter to use Uber, actually, or Lyft.
I just feel like they're...
Yeah.
I don't know what it is. It's just, I think taxi cabs are so, you know, ubiquitous and have been around for so long that there's no effort put into it, right? And that, I guess Uber could become that.
Uber introduced competition. This is the classic case, right, of a kind of complacent industry where the cabs are ratty and the experience wasn't great, and then along you can't get them because you got to hail them, and it's just, and along comes a company and comes up with a better way, an app, and somehow manages to get its drivers to drive nicer cars and be cleaner, and that's competition, and they won in that regard. I don't know. I haven't seen any stats that say Uber is more dangerous than a cab. I don't think that's the case.
I wonder if the cab distinction is going to go away at some point here, too. At some point, like in Portland, for example, they have whatever Taxi Magic is called now. I think they rebranded it, but it's basically, you know, they're cabs, but you get an Uber-like experience. It's getting there in terms of ordering them. At some point, maybe all the cars are on demand with, you know, this way, or most of the cars are that
way. Why not?
I could totally see that happening. Yeah.
Now, there are a lot of drivers. I talk to Uber drivers a lot, and some drivers hate Uber. Most drivers hate Uber. Because a lot of times I think these drivers do it because they almost have to. But they don't make as much money as one might think. They don't get tipped. I know this is, of course, everybody knows this by now. But
they can ask now.
Right? I assumed that didn't Uber in the beginning kind of imply you don't have to leave a tip?
Yes.
With the implication, apparently only implication, that they were doing it. There was no tipping ever. And now because of their consent decree with the FTC, they're allowing drivers to put up a sign that says, you know, I don't get a tip if you want to tip me.
I didn't realize they did that.
I didn't either. I feel like a jerky jerk for years.
Thought it was built in.
Did you did too?
Yeah.
It's
not
just, okay.
You're not even allowed to ask for it or receive a tip.
No, you are. Now you are. Now you can ask for it or receive.
But you can't tip in the app, which is still a problem.
No.
Because a lot of times you don't have cash with you if you're ordering Uber.
The Lyft app allows tipping. There's a button that says, you know, give them 10, give them 15%. But the Uber guys say, we're not going to add that to the app. Because you know what? They want to imply it's cheaper.
Yeah. I ask every Uber driver that I get in the car with if they, you know, drive both Uber and Lyft and if they, what their experience is. And they open right up, you know. And I've seen about a 50-50 kind of split on the happiness with Uber. Some of them think that Lyft, you know, they definitely get paid more. But other Uber drivers have way more success with Uber. So I'm going to guess that's time of day, whether you have a, you know,
if your black car over X makes a difference, right? I'm sure, right?
You know, so all those different factors.
Jason, you've driven for Lyft. My producer, I didn't even know this. You've driven for Lyft and Uber?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Is that now? Do we not pay you enough?
No, it's not that. That's not why I wanted to bring it up, but no. No, I just wanted to speak from experience.
Well, tell me. But it wasn't that recently, I hope.
No, it's been. I was doing it when I first moved up here to
here?
Get settled in. Yeah, around here in Petaluma,
and
San Francisco.
What's your experience? Is it better to drive for one or the other? Is it a good job? Is it a bad job?
It's a great job. I mean, it's fun.
Because you set your hours, right? You decide when you want to work.
Right. I have the app. I turn it on. I say go. And I'm online. And I wait for a call, and I go out and I drive around. And, you know, I could be sitting home playing Xbox, or I could be driving around making, you know, a couple of bucks an hour.
Yeah, see, that's not so bad.
And I mean, I could work a weekend. Like, I usually do the pub crawls, like Friday, Saturday nights from, like, Cotati down to here, and I'll make, like, $250.
I never knew this about you.
It's just fun. You know, I'm sitting at home.
What? Imagine if I had called an Uber and you showed up. How would I feel?
I think I actually drove your daughter once.
Really? Yeah, I hope you said hi. I find it frustrating when there are not enough Ubers around. I really want them to be around. Yeah. I like it. It's so convenient.
I mean, I could go on the app right now and it would ping me in a second.
Now, did anybody ever tip you?
Uber, people offered me tips. I'd always fight them, tell them no. I'm like, don't worry about it. It's, you know, just give me a good rating. Because rating is
worth more than a tip.
Rating is way worth way more.
I always give 5 stars, always. Even if you're crappy, I give you 5 stars.
Wow. And then Lyft, I tried Lyft, but there's not that much demand for Lyft up here.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
One of my drivers told me that if somebody throws up in the back seat, or because you mentioned the pub crawls, if you have an accident.
Happen.
Okay. So they said that they paid for that cleanup. Is that correct?
You pay for it outright, and then you file a claim, and they reimburse you.
Yeah. Okay.
I have doggy bags now.
Hey, but you know what? You're doing God's work, because that person should not be behind the wheel. And the fact that you're taking them home is great.
Right. And that's why I like doing it.
Yeah. That's one of the reasons I tell my daughter. I don't want my daughter behind the wheel at any time.
Yeah.
Let alone when she's drunk. But any time. Yeah. She's 24. She's old enough to have a beer or two.
And, you know, I've got that van, so when I pick up on Friday nights for the you know, from Sonoma State, I've got music playing in there. It's fun.
It's fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've had great conversations, actually, with Uber and Lyft drivers.
Lyft A Motion in the chat says that Lyft actually pays faster.
Yes.
I don't know if that's true, but okay.
Yeah.
Awesome. Wait, do you guys remember the very beginning of Sidecar when everything was donation-based? I don't know if you guys ever did that.
That didn't work too well, did it?
No, I mean, it didn't last very long, but I remember being in San Francisco and literally driving around, and it would just say, you know, we recommend you give them $10, and I could give them anything I wanted,
but
really.
But see, you are the kind of guy, and I think I am too, where we would give them more than the minimum.
Mm-hmm. Those are the sharing economy days, though, right? The idea was, we're all sharing our cars instead of, no, I'm paying for a service.
There's a lot of dopes who would say, oh, good, I can give you $5 then, and would do that.
Oh, yeah. I'd always ask, you know, how often do you get stiffed? And each driver had, you know, I'd say maybe once or twice a night they drive someone. Yeah. Can you imagine driving someone and they just get out? And
sorry,
they
don't
pay you at all.
Doesn't have to. I don't have to pay you. This is the sharing economy.
Mm. No wonder it didn't work.
Thank you for sharing.
Yeah.
We did a whole show on just stories from Uber drivers.
I think so.
Oh, my God.
No, I mean, yeah.
It's like Taxi Cab Confidential, except with an app.
Okay. That's a good conversation. Thank you, everybody. All right, let's talk about TV, because everybody... Now, Apple, for years, has been trying to get a deal to do cable over the Apple TV, basically, over-the-top television. Now, all of a sudden, a story that YouTube's doing unplugged, YouTube unplugged. And it's the same darn story, and it's probably... Kurt, you probably cover this. Equally unlikely, right?
I just think that this ties back to the thing that we were touching on at the very beginning with Facebook and Twitter's deal with the NFL. There is just so much demand for controlling the content that we all watch. And it's not at all surprising that someone like YouTube, you know, wants to kind of graduate from user-generated video, you know, library to something that's more professional and that's something that's you know, the Netflix model, right? Like Netflix has really put this whole idea that we need to buy cable on its head and shown people that, hey, let's pay for what you actually want. I mean, maybe Netflix isn't quite like this, but at least when it started.
Isn't the problem, though, that they're just never going to get these guys to agree to this? For instance, NBC is owned by Comcast. There's no way Comcast is ever going to let anybody do an over-the-top service.
Well, I'm hesitant to say never, because you have to look at, you can be stubborn all you want, but you gotta look at where people are actually consuming, right? Right. I mean,
so the risk is that they'll all just watch YouTube and not watch you at all.
Sure. Or, you know, look at the NFL. I mean, if you'd asked 5 years ago, hey, is NFL going to give up streaming rights to anybody that's, you know, that I think what they sold on Yahoo did a game. Right. Now Twitter's obviously going to do 10 games.
But Twitter's is non-exclusive, and it's just $1 million. It's like $1 million extra.
It's a test. It's a test thing, yeah. Right? Sure, but my point is that the idea that the NFL would be that freewheeling with its rights, 5 years ago, would have been ridiculous.
They're acknowledging the climate. Yeah.
Got to go where people are, right? You got to go and you got to find where people are going to – what they're willing to pay and where they're willing to pay for it. And I think this idea that, you know, we all want specific channels and not others, and we want to watch them on the internet. I mean, that's a real thing. And it's only a matter of time before someone comes in and figures out the model that's going to work, or has the relationships built in place where they can convince a Comcast or someone like, hey, you know, we can help you with distribution and make this an important, you know, part of your business, because there's a lot of people who actually want this. So Hulu, I don't know when it's going
to
happen.
Hulu might have an inside track, and apparently they're also trying to put something together, because they are partly owned by the networks. They're owned by Walt Disney, 21st Century Fox, Comcast, NBC Universal is a silent partner in Hulu, but that's only because they were required to shut up by the FTC. Be interesting to see if they could put this together. They may be the first company to be able to do this.
Now, YouTube isn't trying to take that stuff and put it on TV. They're just trying to.
Yeah, they're trying to.
I thought they were trying to curate kind of topics within YouTube and the set-top boxes.
No, they're doing that as well, but they want to be. So the whole idea is, okay, if people are going to cord cut, how are they going to watch TV? And all of these online services like Apple TV, Hulu and YouTube would like to be the new way you watch TV.
Well, the problem is everybody is offering something for a different price. We think it's cheaper,
the Hulu service would be $40 a month. So it wouldn't be cheaper. It wouldn't, because you still have to pay for your internet. So, of course, the cable companies, where most people get their internet, Comcast is number one, have been slowly jacking up the internet prices because they know they're going to start losing the premium TV subscribers. All right, no problem. We'll charge you $60, and then we'll get a little chunk of the Hulu $40
and putting in some bandwidth caps too while they're at it.
Well, now here's the good news: they just raised those bandwidth caps.
Yeah, but still, it's like Comcast is looking at a terabyte, which is fine now, but it will probably. We will end up in a cell phone kind of tariff state at some point. Sure.
Yeah. Well, they're gonna, in one way or another, Comcast is not gonna lose money by hook or by crook. They are gonna make the same revenue.
They own the pipe, right?
Right. They own the content and the pipe.
Yeah.
I do love the fact that we're kind of moving towards a society where we're willing to pay for the actual content, you know, that we enjoy. I think that's a long time coming and needed. And so I think what we're seeing is definitely a move towards that direction. I would like to see it kind of, there's a new browser, right? Actually, there have been a couple of browsers and apps that allow you to pay for the content that you actually consume. And the websites
Google
that
Contribute
you visit.
Is one. And the folks at the Adblocker, Adblock Plus, are going to do the same thing where you pay a little. I actually do Google Contribute. It's maxed out at $10. And I see little putty tats wherever I would see. Not putty tattoos, putty cats, where I would see. Well, you got to be careful with this crowd. Where I would see normally see ads that Google would provide. And then the publisher gets a little slice of that. And I like it because I have little kitty cats everywhere.
I think that's really cool.
Yeah. So YouTube wants to put together basically a bundle of cable channels they want to be your cable company, basically.
Google's doing this, by the way. They have Google Fiber.
Well, they're doing it where Alphabet. They are your cable company. That just kind of like...
Alphabet's doing it is what I should say. It's one of their,
It's like AT&T's U-verse or Verizon Fios. They offer TV service, cable service.
Right. It's more of a Comcast competitor.
It's
a traditional direct Comcast competitor. But I mean, shows that Alphabet is interested in this idea. So I guess it does not surprise me that another Alphabet property, YouTube, would be trying to tackle the same thing, but in a different way.
Triple Ad nailed this in our chat room. He said, I don't want to buy channels. I want to buy shows.
Yeah.
And I think that's really what users want.
But you can do that now. You can buy shows on iTunes or Google Play, and it adds up fast. If you only want to watch one or two shows, it's a better deal to do that than to pay it for cable. But if you watch 10 shows, it suddenly becomes a terrible deal.
Yeah, no, you're right. I bought, if you buy Game of Thrones, it's like, $50 or something? It's ridiculous.
Yeah, what is a HBO cost for the entire run of Game of Thrones? Right. It's,
Well, but you can't do that. You can do that, sure, on iTunes with, big shows, but you can't do that with your favorite. You can through YouTube Red, for instance, but, it's not the same. Like, in my view, it's not the same thing, going through iTunes to get a big show that's out there, like... I don't know any shows that are out there.
My point is just that buying a show doesn't scale very well, because if you watch more than a few shows, this is the fallacy of that. Well, I'm going to be a cord cutter and I'm going to save money because they're not going to charge me for the channels I don't watch. But the economics don't work. Eventually, unless you don't watch very much TV at all, you'll pay anyway. You'll just be paying for the specific stuff that you want to watch, which might be, it's more freedom, but it's not like a lot of people aren't going to save any money because, it doesn't scale if you watch more than a couple of things. If you're a cord cutter who only literally wants to watch HBO, great, or Netflix, great, but then you start adding in other programming and it gets messy really
fast.
But
ideally, you would want this direct drive between the viewers and the creators where, just as, you would like to see this with the music industry, and of course it's long way off, but a few artists like Jonathan Colton, I pay him directly. I like his music. I buy his songs. He gets the money.
My website has a subscription, and we're going to put together a membership thing for the Incomparable podcast. We're going to do one for that.
And that's
direct, right? And that I think that works. Although, again, I worry that ultimately people are going to tire of having a whole bunch of $5 a month
50
subscriptions
podcasts
to their favorite things.
I listen to, and each one is $5. That's a lot of money.
That's a lot of money.
We're actually going to talk about podcasts in just a little bit, because the New York Times had a front page story today in the Sunday Times that was all wrong. And as podcasters, I think we need to explain what's wrong. That's coming up in just a little bit. Our show today brought to you by GoToMeeting. Be a meeting MVP. Take your meetings to the next level with GoToMeeting. It is the way to have a meeting, whether it's just a conference call. In fact, usually if I'm setting up a conference call, we'll set up with GoToMeeting. I can meet with anybody around the world. Of course, clients and colleagues. But if I want to turn on my screen sharing. Now they can see my screen. They can see the PowerPoint presentation, or we can collaborate in a document. And if I turn on my camera, now they can see me and I can see them. And suddenly, it's like a face-to-face meeting without any of the inconvenience or expensive travel. I love GoToMeeting for this. Start a meeting with a click of the mouse. And by the way, very easy for your clients. You don't want to make them jump through hoops to meet with you to see your sales presentation. And they won't. They get an email. They click a link. 30 seconds later, they're seeing you. They're seeing your presentation. Clients prefer it. They prefer it. No more 8 martini lunches. And they, I got to talk to the guy. I just want to see, what is he offering? You can pass off presenter duties with ease. So it's really easy to have multiple presenters in multiple places. Share your screen. Share your video. Even send private chats and video links. GoToMeeting. Time to put on your best performance and be a meeting MVP. Your free 30-day trial awaits. GoToMeeting.com. Go there right now. You'll see an orange button that says try it free. Click that. And I'm telling you, within 2 minutes, you'll be up and running with GoToMeeting. We're talking about the week's tech news, as we always do on a Sunday afternoon, with some of the smartest people in the tech business. Luria Petruccia is here. Her new Enterprise Geeks University.
Yeah.
What do I learn at a Geeks University?
So we have free content and free courses. We teach people how to use live streaming and online video to grow their business, to get more traffic, more fans, more sales, all of that good stuff.
So it's what we were just talking about with, like, Elon Musk. He really knows how to pull those strings and how to do it. You teach people how to do that.
Yeah, I've been doing it for 10 years. And so we take all of that, all the lessons learned, and teach people step by step how to do it. We actually have a free course out right now at geeksuniversity.com/livestream, where we teach people the 3 biggest mistakes that people make with live streams. So if you're doing it, you can.
I'm probably making all 3 of them, aren't I?
You can avoid those mistakes. Yeah. Yeah, so.
Don't be old.
That's what you learn, online video and live streaming, all that fun stuff.
Nice. Geeksuniversity.com/livestream. Jason Snell is here. Good friend. I was just, Kate Patello was out here.
Yeah.
And she said to say hi. And I said, well, Jason? She said, of course. He did the Mac tips on Call for Help.
Yeah, you were showing that clip on the what happened last week of you guys being blurry. And I was like, I was on that show.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Back at
Tech It's hard
TV
to believe.
Days.
We've been long doing this long. Ago. The May 11th. Which is, 3 days away, is the 18th anniversary of the launch of Tech TV. It was ZDTV at the time, but 18 years ago. Wow.
It's hard to believe.
Doing this a long time. Doing it longer than that, because I started doing just technology radio in 92. So this is my 24th year.
Oof.
Ay, ay, ay.
Don't you still love it, though?
It's the best beat ever, because it's fun. I mean, this stuff is great. I can't wait to see the new, just got the HTC 10. The reason I got into it back when I started writing for magazines, I bet you have a similar story back in, I started writing for magazines in 78. And is so I could get free software, because I couldn't afford, this stuff was expensive. Floppy disks and all that stuff. And I said to myself, I remember very well, I would like to always have the latest and greatest stuff. And how can I do that? And that's how I got, kind of one of the reasons I got into tech journalism, also because I loved it. And as it turned out, I was kind of able to talk about it in a way that normal people could understand. But Kurt, why did you get into this business? Where did you come from?
I was destined to be the center fielder for the Seattle Mariners.
Oh, man.
And nice. All of a sudden, for some reason,
your dream was
that didn't work out.
It's ruined it.
Exactly. And so I kind of got into journalism doing some sports writing in college.
Oh,
and
neat.
Then I edited the school newspaper. I was editor in chief. And so I moved kind of more into news, because if you're the editor, you kind of got to be able to do a lot more than just sports. And when I got out of school, I had some opportunities in Silicon Valley to do tech and business. And once you kind of get in that pipeline, it's hard to transition, but it's been good. I like it a lot. It's,
are you
if
getting
you're
tired of it?
It's good.
No.
I mean, I have different, I would say, whereas a lot of tech journalists have a strong passion in tech, I wouldn't say that it's necessarily a passion of mine, but it's something, I think that's actually better, because
I agree.
It kind of puts you know, lets me look at it through a lens of someone who doesn't necessarily think of this as a huge part of my life outside of work. Whereas with sports, of course, you know, that is a passion of mine. So right. Maybe I wouldn't have been as objective or would have been harder to cover.
No.
But yeah, I like business writing. It's fun.
I think we do need people who are a little more objective. If people like me and Jason have a failing, and so we love this stuff. And so you kind of are rooting for it all the time. And so that is a disadvantage in some respects.
You got to try to bring some skepticism, whether you're you come with that perspective or you force yourself to have it.
Dvorak taught me that. He hates everything.
He does.
So I realized, and generally speaking, he's right. Right. And I realized that you could just make your rule be everything sucks. And about 80% of the time, you'd be right. You'd have a very good track record. So I learned that you should be skeptical out of the box almost always. We just got the HTC Vive. And I have to say, that is really interesting. That's the one that has hand paddles and sensors around you. And we've been playing with it in the other room. And there's something that I was skeptical about for a long time. And I'm starting to get the VR.
Good to start religion. From a place of skepticism, though, right? Like, prove it to me. Show me why this is something.
Well, and you probably all do this. I don't want to be a cheerleader for something that ends up being a flop.
Yep.
Which has happened, for sure. But you really don't want to get people to buy stuff that then they go, Leo, you were wrong. This thing is crap. So.
I like to focus on only tech that matters, you know, only stuff that really impacts, you know.
We all hope to do that, but it's hard not to become a fanboy, you know.
Well,
anyway,
sure.
this HTC 10 is nice, and I'm a fan of the HTC company. I wanted them to do a phone that they, and I loved the M7 and the M8, the original HTC ones, but there were things missing on that, and I think we've really, Android is very interesting. It's really matured the Android space to the point where there's not much to distinguish this from the other top-of-the-line Android devices like the LG G5 or the Galaxy S7. It's a fair, tiny amount of differences between them.
There's some beautiful premium Android
phones. If you're willing to pay $600 or $700 for a phone, that's the problem. They're very expensive. But this is if you're an HTC fan, I think you'd like this. The battery life, not quite as good as the S7. Camera, not quite as good as the S7. Screen not quite as good as the S7, so I still think the S7 is the phone to beat these days. But it does have a Type C connector. I long for the days when Apple and everybody else shifts over to this new connector. I don't know if Apple will do it. They just changed to Lightning.
Right, it might happen someday.
There'd be a backlash. All those people bought.
I think
Lightning
you'll see stuff. It on all the Macs first before you'd see it on the iPad.
And you are seeing it on the MacBook, which is interesting.
As somebody with a big iPad Pro, I actually kind of think
would have been better
the boat in having not having USB-C on the iPad
would have been better
Pro,
yeah because you get not just a charger and not just a USB port, but you get really fast connectivity up to Thunderbolt 3 connectivity, which is 40 gigabytes per second, or is it 40 gigabits per second, but you also can put video out of this at the same time. Mm-hmm. So it's really kind of the do-all port. It's really an amazing port. But if somebody's asking in the chat room, Galaxy S7 is the one. It's still the one. The one to beat on the Android side. And I feel for you, Jason, because you will never be allowed to carry an Android device.
I have a Nexus 5X at home that I use as my Android reference.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, I can see how bad Apple Music is on Android every so often. Right?
All right, we should talk about Apple Music. Because I am interested in this story, and we were debating this. I was debating this earlier today with the chat room. You probably all saw the post on Vellum by a composer who kind of echoed what Jim Dalrymple had said about Apple's music losing his music. The guy on Vellum is a composer who said his piece was titled "Apple Stole My Music." No, seriously, this is James Pinkstone. This is very similar to what Jim Dalrymple said.
Yeah, it gets some details wrong is the problem with it. Serenity Caldwell wrote a nice piece at iMore saying Apple probably didn't delete your music off of your... I think this is Apple's fault, and probably not even because it's a bug, but because Apple's service, especially their matching features...
Confusing.
And the way that the software is written in iTunes and the dialog box you get, if you accidentally press the delete key, you get this bizarre dialog box that gives you these choices, all of which send, other than cancel, send your files to the trash. and not understanding how Apple Music matches your music and how you your downloads work. It's so complicated, and you can very easily get to a point where you lose the music that isn't protected, and that all the music you've got is protected, DRM'd, and if you cancel, you lose your files. You can get there without realizing you get there, which is what I suspect happened to the person who wrote this story.
That's ridiculous. I mean, that can't happen from a company's perspective.
I wouldn't assume user error, because I always hate to assume user error.
Yeah, it's the problem is his story is very much like, I talked to an Apple genius who said this is totally a feature, and it's not a feature.
Wrong.
He's
yeah.
absolutely wrong about that. The Apple person was wrong in telling him that. And
Let me give you
the story. So it's either a bug or it's a misunderstanding. Either way, it's bad and it's Apple's fault.
Right.
Yeah.
So here's what happened. He, as many of us apparently used Apple's iTunes Match.
Yeah, although there's a match feature in Apple Music.
So Apple Music will do
similar.
It.
Yeah.
So he had his own compositions, because he's an amateur composer. So he had his own compositions on the hard drive. They were in iTunes. He also had, and this to me seems more likely, he had rare versions of some songs, like Fountains of Wayne's I'll Do the Driving. Now, there is a Fountain of, he had a Fountain of Wayne's.
I've got that song.
Live.
Both of those versions.
Yeah, demo or something.
It's like an earlier version that's mixed differently. I've got it too. Same song.
And then he also had.
Why don't you give it to him then?
But the problem is Apple. The good news is he had backups. So he did not lose anything. But he says what happened was Apple Music matched that to the single, not to this rare original version, and deleted. And this is the real question mark, because he asserts in here, and I don't think this is the case, but that Apple deletes music once it's matched.
Yeah, that's not true.
I don't think this is true. And he claims an Apple person told him this. I'm sure that's not true. When he says, when I signed up for Apple Music, iTunes evaluated my massive collection of MP3 and WAV files, scanned Apple's database for what it considered matches, and we all acknowledge those matches could be wrong easily.
And frequently are wrong, yes.
But this is the thing I question. He says, then removed the original files from my internal hard drive. Removed them, deleted them. If Apple Music saw a file it didn't recognize, which came up often, since I'm a freelance composer and have many music files I created myself, it would then download it to Apple's database, delete it from my hard drive, and serve it back to me when I wanted to listen. That's not behavior that iTunes does.
That's not how it's designed. Now, is it possible that there's some weird bug in iTunes that caused this to happen? Yeah, I suspect we would have heard about it sooner.
Probably user error, but I hate to judge it. And God knows, iTunes is buggy enough, and Apple Music has enough problems. And Jim Dalrymple, who is not an unsophisticated user, had a very similar experience.
Yeah, the difference is, what happened with Jim is that his metadata all got messed up, and that also if you're on a machine.
He claimed originally that a significant amount of music was also deleted.
Yeah, but again, I'm not unclear whether that happened because it deleted it or because
he
misunderstood. Because, I mean, seriously, the dialog box that when you hit delete, one of the options is remove download, which implies it's this transitory file you downloaded from the internet. Oh. What it really does is it throws your music in the trash. And there it is.
Nice.
You got it. It's.
Are you sure you'd want to delete this song? Well, now I would say not, right?
Right. So delete song is scary. Remove download. Okay, well, that sounds safer because it's just a download. That's fine. I can get it back. But if it's mismatched it, then that download is actually your original file, even if you ripped it from an MP3
or
created it yourself, and then it'll just throw it in the trash. And the next time you say, hey, I'm short on disk space, I'll empty the trash, boom, you've deleted your files. And you can't get them back because the ones that Apple keeps up on the server are wrong because they're a mismatch,
right?
Like that Fountains of Wayne song.
So there's no question that there's mismatching happening, but that happens. CDDB would do that all the time, too.
I think that, I mean, Apple.
That's hard to do.
I think Apple is overconfident about its ability to match songs. And if you've got any live albums, it'll match them to studio albums. If you've got rarities, it will mismatch them. It happens all the time. It's a mess. And the biggest problem is, although that should be better and Apple should be less confident in it, there's also literally no way to say, you got this wrong. Just take my freaking file and put it in the cloud. You can't override iTunes Match or iCloud Music
Library.
Well,
that's a flaw.
You can't say, please just put my rarities in the cloud. You can't do it.
Yeah. So I think that probably Pinkstone is wrong in asserting that Apple's, I mean, and maybe Apple did tell him this, some renegade service.
Yeah, but it's not, if you look at the descriptions on Apple's website.
It's not what's supposed to happen.
It's not supposed to happen, right? This is not a policy. And I think he, understandably angry because he lost his files, but it's not like this is Apple's policy. They find your music and destroy it. That's not it. Either there's a bug or it's just terrible design. And it all comes back to the fact that, you know, it's merging your library with what's on the cloud in the music service.
Right.
And it's probably there was another piece that Serenity wrote on iMore this week that was basically maybe Apple should stop trying to match your music with the cloud and just let you have your music and let you have Apple Music in the cloud and keep them separate, because then this stuff wouldn't happen.
Yeah. New York Times article, front page of the Sunday Times. I was all excited. I saw, podcast surge on the front page of the New York Times, Sunday Times. But producers fear Apple isn't listening. When I saw that, I thought, huh? So the article, I think, got it wrong in almost every respect. Thank God for Marco Arment, who wrote a response in which he said Apple, the New York Times got this wrong in almost every regard.
It's very rare when you see content creators say, hey, we would like a new... I mean, this is literally like saying we would like somebody as powerful as YouTube or Facebook to be the intermediary and take control of what we're doing.
This worried me because, first of all, the Times did not interview me and didn't interview you, and I don't know anybody they interviewed, though they say they talked to many of the big podcasts.
Right, most of which are NPR people.
Well, that's the problem, is that in New York City, they think podcasting equals NPR.
Yeah, former NPR people, current
interviews
NPR
with over two dozen podcasters and people inside Apple reveal a variety of complaints. The producers, and this is true, although I don't complain about it because we have a good relationship with iTunes, but the podcasters say they're relegated to wooing a single Apple employee for promotion. That's true. That's Steve
Wilson.
He's a great guy. Love Steve.
Yeah.
And that's true. In every country, there's a Steve. Different Steve, but there's a Steve.
There's always a Steve.
You shouldn't be relying on Apple promotion in iTunes if that's what you're relying on anyway. The thing that scared me a little bit more is, according to the Times, Apple brought seven leading podcast professionals to the campus last month to air their case to a room full of employees. The people would speak only, blah, 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 blah. The company made no promises, but several pressing issues for podcasters were discussed in frank terms. And after the presentations, Eddie Q arrived for a closed session with the company's employees. Now, the reason this scares me is because they're saying, Apple should do better, should give us information about our listeners. Apple should count our downloads. Why isn't Apple doing more for us podcasters? And I don't want that.
Yeah, people don't realize Apple doesn't serve podcasts. Apple is a directory of RSS feeds.
They're simply a directory.
And then they've got their own podcast app. And they could do stats from their podcast app. They could write their – and they, in fact, may know those stats already, like what you listen to. They may be monitoring that. But even if they are, that's going to be, 50% maybe of the podcast market, not 100%. So, yeah.
Well, don't...
They have to monitor that because they have to, curate, and they have to show what's hot, what's
no. Okay, so this is important, right? And nobody understands this properly, and it's really, it bugs the heck out of me. Yes, they have a Billboard-style list, right, of the top podcasts. That is a simple count of the number of times that subscribe button is pressed.
Right.
And it heavily weights, if not 100% weights, nobody's really sure, the last few weeks.
Yeah.
So, for instance, and I think if you looked at that, you would assume, the number one podcast, which is always This American Life, by the way, the number one podcast must have more listeners than the number 100 podcast. That's not necessarily true.
Right.
In fact, it's not true. Because I know what my numbers are.
Right, because it's a subscription relationship. It's not a pop music hit
like
single
Billboard
relationship.
It's how many times a subscribe button was pressed this week, basically.
Right, and Apple also MP3, podcasts are MP3 downloads, basically. They're file downloads. And what Apple does not seem to be doing in their podcast app or in iTunes is radioing back, like, where you are in the file, or that you got to the end, or that you listened to the ad.
Advertisers would like that.
They would love that.
But no podcaster wants that information.
I'm not sure the listeners want that either.
And that's the bigger issue. I know my listeners don't want us track you. You don't want us tracking how much of the show you listen to. You don't want us to know that information, or more demographic information about you. We don't want to know that, and I don't want to be in the position of asking Apple for that. I don't think Apple wants to be in the position of collecting that.
Right.
The only people actually asking for that would be advertisers.
I don't think Apple wants to be in the business of it. And I don't want Apple to be in the business of it. But at the same time, I do want that. I do want that information. I want to know kind of where my listeners are. I want to know where, you know, what people are actually paying attention to more and more. Now, with iTunes, you're absolutely right. It's a podcast directory, right? So I get that information from elsewhere. The one thing I would like to see from... I go back and forth on this, but I often find myself wanting more of a connection with the people watching on iTunes or listening on iTunes, because, you know, if even a simple kind of social commenting system or something like that. But then I always come down to the fact that that's not how people use iTunes. It is purely a grab and go system, right? So I mean, I can see where other platforms, other podcasters and big companies are wanting that, because I often find myself like, I can't get to the people watching on
well
on
I would tips, just right? I would just point out that that's what screwed up the web.
I
that desire for blogs to know everything about you is what created ad tech and what created ad blockers. And this is not an arms race that I want to get into, and I think any reasonable podcaster would want to get into. We do surveys every year, and if people want to participate, they can. And that's all we need to know. We don't even really need to know much. We actually have decided our next survey to ask far fewer questions. We don't need to know, you know, that much. We just like to know a little demographic information in general, because advertisers would like to know that. But we do not want to get, and Marco says this, we don't want to get in the situation where advertisers know whether you as a podcast listener searched for a new refrigerator yesterday or whether you listen to ads or whether you listen to it at all. Big publishers and advertisers might want this, but I can tell you right now, this is exactly what we as users don't want, right?
Right.
And we don't want to require, for instance, as I think some would, you have to use the iTunes player so that Apple can then just give us information about whether how many people heard ad 3.
No,
well, some podcasters have decided, I would argue they're not podcasters anymore when they do this, but like they built their own ad or their own app. And they're like,
right.
you
have
to
listen to
things in our app.
Yeah.
And I feel like some of the motivation of them going to Apple and talking about this is like Apple's podcast app and iTunes are so big.
Why can't your app do this for us?
It's an open system, right? It's totally open. And so as long as Apple is just letting people listen to podcasts and not measuring everything they do, it will be very hard for them to get a really good control of the data of podcast listening. And so they're like, no, help us out here. And this is one of those cases where Apple's actually been a very good steward of podcasting.
Yes.
They haven't always been super engaged.
Because they've been hands-off.
But maybe that's all a good thing, right? Ever since 2005 or whenever they put this in, they just sort of keep the directory there. They did roll out some new features for podcast publishers in the last few weeks. You can now get access to your iTunes information on the back end and change it and add podcasts and things, which previously was sort of a secret that only a few people had access to. And that's good. But, you know, it is un-Apple-like in a lot of ways because they're basically just, you know, they don't serve any of the content. All they do is provide the directory, and it's pretty good.
So
do you think, if I could jump real quick, I mean, do you think all of that is basically because up until now podcasts were not really a big business? I mean, I feel like in the last year or two is when podcasts really became a more mainstream thing versus a niche thing, I suppose. And maybe my ignorance is showing here, and that's kind of when I started getting involved in podcasts or listening to them. But do you think that now that it's like, hey, this could actually be a business, all of a sudden there's a need and a realization that we need to be able to know who's listening, how long they're listening in order to make the business a reality?
Well, I can tell you, and by the way, you know, the New York Times says there's some funny that the business is worth, what do they say, an advertising business in podcasting is worth something like, what do they say, $57 million. And if that's true, then I actually own 25% of all the podcast revenue in the world. That it is a good business. It's been a very good business for us. And as one of the actual large podcasters and one of the few people making money in this business, the last thing we want to do, and I am with you, Marco, if you're listening, I am so with you, is to, and his last sentence is, in his blog post, is let big data and the desire to make money off of podcasts do to podcasts what it did to the web. This is not where we're going. And I could promise all of our listeners that we will never go that way. And we do just fine, thank you, without using big data and spying on you and keeping track of you. And I bet you, Jason, you would agree that this is not Absolutely. The direction you would want to go in.
It's an open system right now. I mean, the last thing I want to do as a podcaster is end up having to work with a bunch of huge providers that are going to use my data and take advantage of it. And that's really what people are asking for here. And also, yeah, we can see what's happened to the web when the model was
horrible.
Give everything away and measure everything.
Right.
And you actually lose. And it's not just like we're trying to get away with something. That's not the case. There's a lot of stuff that gets devalued when you only measure things the way that web ads are measured. And,
Absolutely.
You know, when you look at TV ads or print ads or billboard ads, there are lots of ads that are not directly measurable. You use indirect means to do it. And those businesses are, you know, relevant advertising businesses. Not everything needs to be a text link that you click on and get a referral link on.
Yeah, it says.
I definitely fear the, you know, the direction that we're going, where people put more attention on those numbers than the actual effectiveness. It happens across social. You know, yeah. Everybody's like, you have 2 million social media followers. Awesome, but what's the effectiveness of it? We have to spend more effort pushing that, and Leo, you do that wonderfully, you know, but than any kind of number-based system. But I am kind of curious, since we're talking about kind of ads and retargeting and all of that stuff, from the audience and from you guys' perspective, when I'm, as much as I want my privacy protected, I also appreciate when I see an ad that's specific to what I want. Like, I don't actually pay any attention to ads until, right? I mean, that's just natural.
No, in fact, so much advertising is wasted because it's advertising to somebody who is never going to be buying that product.
Right. And I guess, I mean, if we go with what, you know, we've all done for years, it's based on the host and the producer to decide, to talk to the audience and decide, you know, what ads are most relevant.
Yeah, we do something, and I think you do the same thing. I know Jason does this, that's very different from the traditional model, which is we try to bring advertisers to people that we know our audience wants. And we know our audience because we're niche broadcasters. Although I guess I'm bigger than I thought, because according to the New York Times, there are 46 million Americans listen to podcasts each month. And since we have 12 million, I think we actually have a large share of
Good
the
job.
Podcast. Yeah.
Congratulations.
Good work.
These numbers are wrong. They're just wrong. And it's all because you nailed it. It's Serial and Gimlet and all of these New York-focused ex-NPR people who are, podcasting is a grassroots movement.
I can try to channel them a little bit. I get what they're saying in the sense that right now it's very hard to get even consistent numbers in terms of like what's a download, what's a listen, what's your subscriber base, how is that calculated? And I get trying to find out. NPR people have been trying to do that. They made a document that's like, here's what we think listenership should be defined as. And it's a new medium. That's going to happen. I get that. I kind of can't get the idea that they're saying, you know, hey, Apple, why don't you come in here and be heavy-handed. Stop it with this light touch. Why don't you just take control like you did with the music industry and with
the... Yes, please.
Yeah, that's a terrible idea.
This is like 50 Shades of Podcasts. Please take me, Mr. Apple. They talk with a woman from a podcast called Call Your Girlfriend. And she says, with data like listener counts and listening duration similar to what Apple provides app developers, the industry could accelerate quickly.
Oh, good. Can you imagine that?
The benefit of how iTunes is structured is that you as a podcast producer can drive traffic to your own properties and not be owned by, you know, a YouTube or something. So, I mean, you can still drive traffic regardless of what platform you're on. But if they go down, you go down if you put all your eggs there. So.
Yeah. And what we really don't want, and of course, Marco, who has some experience with the App Store, we really don't want Apple to create an App Store experience out of podcasting. Yeah. That's really not the right way to go.
Podcasting is free. Anybody can do it. They don't need to go to a particular provider. You put up your feed. You put up your files. People can find you in the iTunes directory and the Google Play directory and other places. And it's a pretty great thing right now. And I
fear we're hippies. And that I know.
Just chill out, man.
Wall Street's a coming.
I think it's actually because we teach online video and stuff to people just getting into it, because we've been around around this world for so long. People just getting into it, they find iTunes extremely confusing.
Oh, it's horrible.
Because it's not like YouTube. It's not like Facebook. With those, it's very simple to figure out, okay, you create a channel and you upload your stuff there. They take care of all the hosting. And then you go to iTunes and you want to be there. From that perspective, it's actually very confusing from a platform stance. So
Steve Wilson, I know you listen. Jason and I, we love you. Keep up the good work at iTunes.
Yes.
Yeah. And don't listen to whatever those people you brought in told you. We like what you're doing just fine. Just keep it
Steve
the way it is.
Steve has awesome work.
You know him too.
Apple has done right by podcasters for a long time.
Thank you.
In terms of being open, and I'm not saying like kickbacks, I'm saying like they're open to whoever and have really embraced that the next great podcast can come from anywhere,
and
not
I like
just
Steve's,
from somebody who used to work at a public radio
I like
station.
Steve's boss, James Boggs, too. Yep. He's a really nice guy.
Yeah, well, I feel for those guys because they're in the New York Times
all
now,
of a sudden.
So they got a whole bunch of email coming their way.
Hey, I have a podcast. Maybe you can help me. Let's take a break, and we'll wrap this up with some light, airy, fluffy stories to leave you with a wonderful...
Kitty cats,
a wonderful
Yay.
Taste in your mouth. That's the deal. I want to talk about stamps.com. Somebody in the chat room said, I'm a 59-year-old white male. There's nothing you could advertise I'd be interested in. I bet this is. Do you ever, as your business, you mail brochures, bills? Do you send out packages? Do you sell on Etsy or eBay or Amazon? And you're using the Postal Service? I got so much of a better way to do it. Stamps.com. It's everything the post office brings you without leaving your desk. So it starts by, of course, buying and printing official postage from your desk using your computer and printer. No postage meter, your computer and your printer. But it gets even better because with Stamps.com, post office loves Stamps.com. And with Stamps.com, you get discounts you can't get at the post office. You can use their digital scale to make sure you have exactly the right postage on any kind of postage, whether it's a media mail or a box or an envelope or a postcard. It's just awesome. With Stamps.com, I'll walk you through it. Go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone on the right, enter TWIT. You're going to get the Stamps.com kind of no-risk trial offer. That includes that digital scale right there, the USB scale. You get a $5 supply kit. You get $55 in free postage, too. So you plug the scale into the USB port. You log into your account. You click on print postage at the top of the page. You could print on plain paper. You could print right on an envelope with your company logo, the return address. You could print a stamps.com label that you slap on the package. It looks pro. It looks great. You know exactly what the item weighs. You know exactly how much postage. And by the way, Stamps will suggest mailing options, all classes of mail, including certified mail, and tell you how much it's going to cost, and you choose. It's so awesome. And then the mail carrier comes and picks it up and takes it. You never got up. It takes all the guesswork out of getting postage. It is a better way, and it makes you look more professional. That's really important. If you're an Etsy seller, an eBay seller, an Amazon seller, you will look pro. And it's saving you time and money. Go to Stamps.com. Again, click the microphone, use the promo code TWIT. You're going to get the 4-week trial. You're going to get the $110 bonus offer. That includes the postage and the scale. That is a much better deal than on the front page. So make sure you do that. Click the microphone and use the offer code TWIT at Stamps.com. We use it all the time. Actually, it was Carly showing off the Stamps scale. Have you been following? Anybody follow the Bitcoin Satoshi Nakamoto soap opera? I'm just loving this. Just loving this. Dr. Craig Wright says, I'm Satoshi.
Yep,
I am. I'm him. I am, really. And I'm going to prove it by posting a screenshot of some Unix code, Linux code. That'll prove it. And maybe I'll cut and paste a cryptographic signature from somewhere else that looks really real. And the sad thing is, The Economist and BBC kind of fell for it, And probably because Gavin Andreessen, who is was the former director, I've interviewed him on Triangulation, the former director of the Bitcoin Institute, and one of the few people who corresponded with the actual Satoshi Nakamoto some time ago. And when Nakamoto dropped out of sight in 2011, took over for him to run Bitcoin, said, "Oh, yeah, it's Satoshi. I recognize him anywhere." I think Gavin's backed off a little bit. He's the chief scientist at the Bitcoin Foundation. And Dan Kaminsky is one of our favorite hackers. Wrote a great article. He was a little puzzled, so he emailed Gavin and said, "What's going on here? There's clear, unambiguous cryptographic evidence of fraud, and you're lending credibility to the idea that a public key operation could, should, or must remain private." So even though, oddly, Gavin did not post this on his blog, he responded to Dan Kaminsky. He said, "Yeah. What the heck? I was as surprised by the proof as anyone, and yet I don't know exactly what's going on. It was a mistake to agree to publish my post before I saw his. I assumed his post would simply be a signed message. Anyone could verify it wasn't." So he's backed down a little bit. The whole thing was just another one of those stories, like Newsweek's story a couple of years ago saying we found him. No one has found him. Mostly because it'd be very easy to prove you were Satoshi Nakamoto.
You just got to spend one of those Bitcoins block.
Yep. And Craig Wright won't do it. So bye-bye, Craig. He's fled the country. He was in Australia, and he was fled the country because he's being investigated by Australian tax authorities. Oh, there. Okay.
Yeah. Goodbye.
Where is that? Is that Gavin's blog?
That's Craig's blog.
He says, "I'm sorry. I believe that I could do this. I believe that I could put the years of anonymity and hiding behind me." Classic con man. Never admit. Never admit guilt. "But as the events of this week unfolded, I prepared to publish the proof of access to the earliest keys I broke. I don't have the courage. I can't do it. When the rumors began, my qualifications and character were attacked. When those allegations were proven false, new allegations have already begun. I know now I am not strong enough for this." Oh, that's it. It's not that I can't do it. I'm just not strong enough. "I know that this weakness will cause great damage to those that have supported me, particularly to John and Gavin, and I can only hope that their honor and credibility is not blazer tainted by their ashes. They were not deceived. I know the world will never believe that now. I can only say I'm sorry and goodbye." Oh, man.
Goodbye.
I didn't see that. Thank you for pulling that up, Jason. I hadn't seen his. Oh, I could do it. I could, but I'm not going to. Okay. Little light comedy. Anything else you guys want to talk about before we wrap this thing up? I think you're flagging.
Cats.
Cats. Kitty cats.
Cats, context.
You want to know how I do
cats
that?
Cats with context. Curated cats with context.
Contribute.google.com. Everybody should do this. This is a good solution. Oh.
Nice.
Never mind.
Well, we've done all we can. No, we've done all we can. The
internet's over. Obviously, it's contribute. It's google.com/contribute. If this is wrong, then I'm just going home. I'm sorry. I don't have the strength to go on. I believed in what I was doing, but apparently you don't. What the heck? Is it gone? Am I getting it wrong? Contributor. Thank you. Anyway, the idea is... You see fewer ads and you support the sites you visit. Is Recode one of these? I think it might be because I think I see kitty cats.
I don't know.
I'm curious.
I wish I did know.
Yeah.
But sorry, I didn't.
It doesn't have to be kitty cats, but I happen to choose kitty cats. So you see, I've contributed $10 and I've only spent 77 cents. They give you the money back at the end of the month if you haven't spent it. That's because I'm running an ad blocker too. Whoops. Shouldn't do that. These are all the sites that get a little bit of money every time I visit them. And then in your settings, you can choose, instead of the ads, what you'd like to see. And I choose kitty cats, but it doesn't have to be. It could be anything. But see, wouldn't you like that, Kelly?
I would. I would very much like that.
So here's your choice. You can replace ads with neutral, transparent, or kitty cats. Well, why wouldn't you choose kitty cats?
Not.
You actually can provide your own image if you wish, but...
Well, what's the fun in that? I mean, they're random cats, right?
It's not like it's different every time. It's awesome.
Yeah.
And it's really good on mobile. Because you know, for some reason, sites with mobile, with ads, are worse on mobile. There's just ads everywhere, and then I get kitty cats everywhere. Highly recommended.
They make your day.
Silicon Valley engineering interns make good money. Interns. These are not employees. The average intern in Silicon Valley makes $81,000 a year, according to Rodney Fultz, who's going to be an intern at Yelp soon. That's almost twice what the average wage is in the United States. So get an engineering degree. My son, I'm glad to say, is going to be a Silicon Valley intern this week, this summer. Very happy.
Smart man.
Smart man. I think he's gunning for Patreon. I think he wants to work at Patreon. And I think he's going to do that. I think I sent him a note. Sent Jack a note saying, "Hey, all right, I think we're done. I think I've used up all your energy, all your resources. Your blood sugar is low.
All our cats.
All the cats are gone.
Send chocolate.
Send chocolate fast.
And Gatorade, please.
I warned you, Kurt. I warned you." It's great to have you. Kurt Wagner from Recode, recode.net. What are you covering this week? What are you looking at?
You know, I actually have a big story set to run tomorrow morning in honor of our new design and our new layout.
Oh, but so you're not going to tell us.
I can't say a lot, but it's
top secret.
It's on my beat, which is Facebook, Twitter, Snapchat, social media, that stuff. And I'm very excited. I've been working on it for quite a while. So
nice.
Yeah.
Do they ever have you on the podcast? They ever let you do the podcast, or is it just Kara just hog the whole thing?
You know, she likes to let people guest host. I actually hosted my first episode, but it hasn't been produced yet. But it was just last week. I chatted with a man by the name of Maverick Carter. He's the business mind, the business and branding mind behind LeBron James.
Oh, so see, it was fascinating.
It's kind of a sports business marketing conversation, and we taped it last week, and hopefully it'll go up in the next week or two.
Boy, is that in your wheelhouse?
Oh, it was great. I was pushing for it. And Kara calls it every sport is sports ball to her.
Yeah, yeah.
So she was more than happy, I think, to pass this one over to me.
Most
so
importantly, is she going to get another cameo in Silicon Valley this year?
That's a good question. I actually don't think so.
I think it's Calacanis this time.
Yeah, I don't think she's in this season. But a handful of us got to go to the premiere a few weeks.
Oh, fun. Oh, did you go to that?
Yeah,
how did you get
there,
a ticket
yeah.
to that? I wanted to go to that.
Yeah.
That looked like
fun.
I guess
you got to know the right people.
The right people.
I guess.
I'm interviewing Dan Lyons tomorrow on Triangulation. He's one of the writers. You'd think yeah. I'm gonna put him on the spot tomorrow.
Next year, Dan, you'll get a go then. Sounds like.
Where was my ticket to the premiere? It's still a good show, and that I just love it.
Yeah.
Somebody was saying after last week's episode, it was too real. It was actually, it was like, you know, with the CEO who's saying, you know, we're going to pivot. We're going B2B now. And right. It was like, oh, this is painful. I've been there. Can't watch. Recode.net, Jason. It's great to have you, Jason Snell. So many podcasts, The Incomparable.
Yeah, you can find them.
Pod for Ham, which is all about Hamilton.
Yeah, we got that.
And
we
got to
do a little song about that Feinstein Burr bill, like, you know.
Oh yeah.
Well, if it isn't Feinstein Burr,
sir.
We'll work on it. We'll workshop it.
That's good.
We'll
like it.
You and me. Well, it'll be a duet.
Gotta call in, Manuel.
Nerdiest duet ever.
And of course, sixcolors.com.
Yep.
Great to see you. Thank you for coming up. I appreciate
it. Always a pleasure.
And my dearest, my sweetest, my most wonderful friend, Luria Petrucci. It's so good to see you doing so well.
Thank you.
And the humidity in Portland is great for your hair. All that rain.
It's wonderful weather up here. It's been awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, nice. That's great. And everything's going well at geeksuniversity.com. Get your free trial, geeksuniversity.com/livestream.
Free mini course there for everybody. And then also some free other courses on mobile video at geeksuniversity.com. You just sign up as a limited access member. But we also are doing the tech show daily on Facebook. So that's at 10 a.m. Pacific.
Awesome.
And it's just facebook.com/geekslifenet. So
I don't do enough live video. I want to do more. You know what? I actually have a killer idea, and I've told people this before, so I won't belabor it. But, you know, I ordered that Mevo camera that Mark demoed at F8, the camera that kind of follows you automatically. You don't need a switcher. You could switch on the iPhone, but it also will follow you around. And I figured out, I was thinking, what can I do with this and YouTube video? And I'm going to do Hot Tub Tech Machine. And if you would like to come be my guest in the hot tub anytime.
Hot Tub Tech Machine.
Hot Tub Tech Machine. Join Leo in his hot tub talking about tech.
Oh, boy.
It's a good show. That's from the pilot.
Nice.
I did learn a lesson from the pilot. Wear trunks. I'm just saying it wasn't. From now on.
It's a good life lesson.
Good life lesson, yeah.
You want to make sure you keep that camera far from the steam and use the Mevo app in order to zoom in.
So, no, don't zoom.
From the app.
No zooming.
Well, no.
Zoom out.
I'm just going to shut up.
Great to see you, Luria. Thank you for joining us. I didn't call you Callie more than a couple of times. That's pretty good. I'm happy about that.
You're getting better.
I'm getting better.
It's getting in my head. You and I, I worked
I've
with you.
I've known you as Callie for a decade.
2006, I think it was when we worked together.
Luria co-hosted with me our Call for Help show in Canada for a couple of weeks, right? You came up for a while, a month.
It was, we did 3 months there. Yeah.
3 months.
Yeah. I'm excited to hear you don't remember all of them.
No, they were good. No, you're great. You're the greatest. thanks to everybody who's in our studio audience. Great studio audience. You were wonderful. Mm. Very patient. if you want to be in the studio audience, you too could join this marathon of pain. You just have to email tickets at twit.tv. We'll make sure we put a nice comfy seat out for you. Or maybe not so comfy. Sorry about that. we can't afford good chairs, okay? We also do the show live Sunday afternoon, and that means you can watch on the internet live, not on Facebook yet. Man, you should probably think about that, but on our stream at live.twit.tv, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern time, 2200 UTC. Please do watch live. Join us in the chat room at irc.twit.tv. We'd love that. But if you can't, on-demand audio and video is always available after the fact at our website, twit.tv, but you can also get it in iTunes and every other podcasting application. There's even Twit apps. And you know what? We didn't write them, so we don't use them to collect information on you. I don't even know who you are. I don't know you, but I love you. Get the app, subscribe, be here every week. You don't want to miss a minute. Thank you for joining us. We'll see you next time. Another Twit is in the can. Bye-bye. I don't know you, but I love you.